zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my film.
Hello and welcome to the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and this is my favorite Steam concurrent user number on the Citadel.
Commander Lewis, indeed.
Yes.
Yes. And been a minute, and we're still struggling to get back to a regular recording schedule, but there's been so much news and so many developments.
Yeah, I will say I've given you guys enough Lewis content. You're getting once a week me on one of the main shows. So
that's right. That's right. On MapCheck and Mike and Boars. What would you call it? Yes, there's been Lewis has been keeping the flame alive. But fortunately, I don't know, I guess it depends on your perspective. Not a lot of video game content on the rest of the TRS radio network. So which is fine, which is good. So it falls to us to discuss the various goings on. And there had been I think a fair amount of news already, but then everything has gotten swamped by the release of the fourth entry in the Dragon Age franchise, Dragon Age Veilguard, or Failguard, as some of the kids are calling it. And I think there's just so much there that, I mean, obviously we have to talk about it. I don't even know where to start. Maybe with like an overview of the series, or just you want to get into like the obnoxious tranny shit. Right,
sure, we'll just talk about the history of Dragon Age. Dragon Age was always BioWare's, I guess, B tier behind Mass Effect. Very big in the American Asian community. Well, if you didn't know this, American Asians love Dragon Age. Where the whites,
that's used to me. That's
there's
funny.
A cultural divide.
The whites definitely love Mass Effect. Yes.
Yeah, there's a cultural divide here among like the youth. Where obviously, you know, obviously crossover and things happen. But if you talk to like Asian Americans, they'll talk about Dragon Age. Of a certain age, in that same age cohort, the other guys are all about Mass Effect, like the whites, which is very interesting.
That is, I did not know that, and that's definitely very interesting. I also wanted to say, in terms of like background information, that the Dragon Age was very much pitched before it even launched as a kind of darker, grittier spiritual sequel or successor to Baldur's Gate. BioWare and Baldur's Gate were essentially synonymous. Because they developed the Infinity Engine, which was for the, you know, back half of the 90s and the first part, for the classic CRPGs.
The first Dragon Age is not a RPG, like an action RPG. You pick That's right. who you're attacking
It's a three-dimensional interpretation of essentially the of a lightly modified Dungeons and Dragons type rule set with
it's very much if you've played KOTOR, it's very KOTOR.
Yes, like the first KOTOR, especially. Yeah. Yes, and they were even developed around the same time. KOTOR 1 was BioWare too, right? 2 was Obsidian.
Yes.
If I have that right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Which would go on KOTOR 2, Obsidian Studio would go on to make.
Not to give a blistering hot take, but the Dragon Age games were never that good and never that big. They were acceptable.
Well,
and like
okay,
they were,
so again,
they were very
lucky.
They were very lucky in their time span that kind of like true fantasy D&D type game. It
in
was kind of
2009. There was nothing.
The well had run very dry
for 10 years. There hadn't been anything. Baldur's Gate 2 was what 97, I think, and it had 98. Yeah. The big expansion, which was kind of almost, it was like people were calling it 2.5. It was big enough to have been, it was essentially back in, again, in the 90s and even going into the 80s, games were, they first of all, a lot quicker to develop, but also studios would rely on the underlying tech for longer. So oftentimes you would have either a rushed sequel like XCOM, then Terra from the Deep, right? Which was basically, it could have been an expansion along these lines, or along the lines of, for example, Brood War. StarCraft 1 and then Brood War was very much, it's the same engine, same pretty much everything, larger priced expansion, but in some ways enough content for a full sequel. But because it's on the same engine, because the development was so short compared to the development of the main game, which also wasn't, I mean, this game, Veilguard, it's been 10 years. And most of that time, or at least much of it, has been, I mean, they were talking about active development at least 8 years, right? I mean, this is now that's something of an outlier, but
I just want to point out that the Dragon Age games are not good. I have never finished.
I like the first one.
I have played until this one, all of them.
Yeah. Okay.
They are absolute snooze fests.
Yes, that is true. Like, yes. Sorry, go on.
They are aggressively boring. The only reason most people got into them, including myself, I was like a latecomer, I guess, was that Mass Effect was so fucking good. You're like, I want more of this thing.
I'm going to push back on that slightly, product. Just with the first one, because that's definitely true.
It's not fun, though. It's better made, but it's not enjoyable to play.
No, the combat and stuff, I mean, it's okay. On the harder, if you're, okay, again, putting yourself in the frame of, like, it's 2009, it's been more than a decade since the last Baldur's Gate. I guess you had Icewind Dale in, like, 99 or 2000, maybe, but even all that right. doesn't really...
If I was to argue, DK, that MREs are the most delicious food on Earth, and I said, you put yourself, it's been 48 hours since you've ate, you've been marching up a hill for 2 days straight, and someone hands you an MRE, it's delicious. You're like, well, MREs are the best meal on Earth. You'd be like, oh, Lewis, you're a fucking retard. You were hungry. You're like, that's what you're telling me. It's like, wow, this food is great when you're hungry. It's like, yeah, nigga, it's food. Like, video games are enjoyable inherently. No, Dragon Age games fucking suck. Let me give you a situation. You played Mass Effect 2. It blew your fucking little mind. And you're like, wow, I want more of this.
Oh, more of this.
Like,
oh, look.
Let me buy the DLC. Let me play the first game. The first game, not quite as good. I kind of struggle through certain elements of it. But like, okay, this is more Mass Effect. Now, oh, dang, and I'm all out of Mass Effect. I got to wait till the third sequel comes out.
Right.
Oh, there's two more Mass Effects out? There's like a Dragon Age 1 and 2? Oh, they're like unplayable. They are the most unenjoyable combat I've felt in my entire life. Like, probably ruined me for like Western RPGs until like, except for Skyrim. Skyrim's a different thing. Like, actually, it ruined me for that type of RPG. Yeah, totally.
I would here's my blistering hot take. You ready? Nuclear hellfire take. Elder Scrolls games have never been good. Never, not one. All of them suck.
This is just wrong. Like, the market has spoken on this front, sir.
Well, you can say the same thing about Dragon Age. I mean,
no,
we'll get into the
Dragon Age issue. Never touched Mass Effect sales numbers.
That's true. That's well, okay. But I do want to say one other thing. Not exactly in the defense of Dragon Age 1 so much as in. Is that like it's? I don't know. Definitely, a lot of that was people, yes, coming over from Mass Effect and discovering BioWare. There was also a healthy contingent of George R. R. Martin fans prior to the HBO Game of Thrones. Like, Dragon Age 1 was pitched as the Game of Thrones RPG as much as it was pitched as the spiritual successor to Baldur's Gate and especially Neverwinter Nights. And like, it was to the point where I think a lot of like. Essentially, the only good things about the game as a plot are the things that were just ripped straight from A Song of Ice and Fire. All the rest of it is trash. The Darkspawn is boring as fuck. I waited around for the game, for the series, to have something interesting to say. It never did. I'm not going to, like, push back.
There are fans of it. I am getting to do this bit, which I understand is, I believe it in my heart. I've always believed this. But there are fans of Dragon Age for some reason. Like, but now they're black-pilled, so I can go with these kind of statements. Like, it did have its fans.
I enjoyed the first one. I got, if not 100% on Xbox achievements, very damn close to it. A lot of things, I mean, again, I'm not going to, like, sit here and defend everything about the combat system and certainly not the kind of overarching plot.
Dude,
about,
if they just made that game with, like, Mass Effect combat and you were firing spells instead of a gun.
It would be great. Yeah,
it'd be great. They refuse. They're used deliberately bad combat systems that
whatever. Also yeah, tiresome. I mean, well, and so then and then you had this take before the show, which also, I mean, while we're sort of this retroactively makes all the other games like just this.
Oh, dude, now, it exposes BioWare writing style in ways that horrify me.
Yeah, I don't want to get into maybe we can. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much there is to say honestly, except for. Just for my own personal history, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say about the second and the third. The second, I didn't think was as bad as people said, but it was obviously rushed and kind of trash as far as...
Let me tell you why it's garbage.
Yeah.
The first thing they tell you about the Darkspawn in that game, because I played that one first. I went back and played that one, was like, oh, this is garbage, couldn't finish it. And then was like, oh, no, the first one's better, And then I got like 6 hours into that one, and I realized it sucked too. But the first thing they tell you in Dragon Age 2 is that like, if Darkspawn, like, blood gets on you, you get, like, Darkspawn cancer and die, like, for sure. Like, okay, that's a fun thing. And then there's a system in the game where if you spend any amount of time in, like, close combat, your character's just covered in blood.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So like, my guys are just covered in like cancer blood, and I'm like, well, oh, they're all dead now, right? Or they're gonna solve this, or that'll be a plot point. No, they just never talk about it again. And every time you fight the Darkspawn, this happens. Dude, what a stupid game.
Everything is like that in 2. It picks up in the back half, and I enjoyed what they did with the Kunari. But yeah, it was basically just kind of trash. And I actually haven't played the first one since I 100%ed it or close to it on Xbox. So I guess I just have those memories, and I can, you know, enjoy it with the patina of old age or something. I hated Inquisition. That was the first and I think only game I've ever like hate completed was Dragon Age Inquisition. I was like, this is garbage. I hate this. But I kept like, I was like, maybe there's something somewhere that will redeem it. No. It just fucking sucked. I don't even know where. I don't know. It's hard for me to empathize.
My favorite part of every Dragon Age game is once you hit the point where like, oh, your attacks just don't damage enemies anymore. You're like, I have to like fix this? No, fuck you. Like I fire the fireball at the guy.
Inquisition was also the first game that I had ever, like, I started it on hardcore, because that was the thing, at least whenever, and again, this was, 10 years ago, so it was a lot closer to the launch of the first one. I played a bunch of the first Dragon Age on the hardest difficulty, doing, like, the tactical real-time pause thing, enjoying it at least somewhat. And it didn't feel super, like, enemies were deadly, but so were you. Inquisition was the first, and I believe, to date, only game that I've ever, I was so disgusted by the design of the the combat and enemy encounters, because it was very clear like there was nothing tactically interesting about anything. It was literally just sponges. It was like, adjust how much of a sponge you want enemies to be. And I'm like, well, I want them to have, you know, as much, like, I don't want them to be a sponge at all, so I guess I'm just going to lower this all the way.
Yeah, well, thank God you can enjoy the riveting story of Dragon Age 1-3.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and well, that was also the point, I believe, because like that was the point where BioWare's marketing really started transitioning, I guess pun intended, to like, oh, we're all about companions and like companion romance in Baldur's Gate. I don't even think it existed in the first one. You could kind of do like there was a sort of a side plot in the second one that was developed in the expansion. I don't believe Aerie was the only romanceable companion, but she was the only one with any like actual writing devoted to that party member interaction. It wasn't like maybe your experience differed in Mass Effect. It wasn't the thing I remember most about the romance options in Mass Effect was the retarded Republican senators going up and being like, this is a sex simulator. And shit like that. It was very much pitched in terms of the like early noughties George W. Bush era culture war type stuff. But it wasn't like leading on the marketing. It wasn't like, you know, this is our first on our bullet point of why you should buy this game is you can have like imaginary sex with some character that you know that the Inquisition era, even more so I think than the Mass Effect 3. Which obviously, you know, it has its problems, and we've talked about them before, and we'll talk about them again. Mass Effect 3, also the marketing for that was, you know, here's this epic, you know, you're going to end the Reaper threat once and for all, right? It was very much about the main story, and then to some extent about these and these side missions, which everyone acknowledged was the best thing about them, but it wasn't like the main thing. This is all the marketing I've seen, all of the way that BioWare and EA are pitching this is about like, oh, you know, look at these quirky characters. And I just want to vomit.
Well, also, just to talk about why Dragon Age is bad, Mass Effect romances are not like super deep and like whatever love interest stuff. But in Dragon Age, like it literally gives like a heart option over the dialogue wheel to like, if because like, it's like, oh, are you retarded? Like, can you not figure out like how you can do the romance? Yeah, it's like,
again, one, I don't actually know that all that much about Veilguard. One of the things that I know is that BioWare was so concerned by people, like, I guess there were people who didn't realize they were initiating romance with one of their party members, or they didn't realize they were cutting it off. So they, like, not only do they have, like, heart icons in the dialogue spinny wheel, it has, fourth wall breaking developer text hovering over above the dialogue saying, if you do this, you will initiate a romance with this character. It's okay. Like, I don't know what to do with that.
It's a game for the, I will say that there are probably about 100,000 autistic non-binary gamers who will enjoy this game. Yeah. And I don't even have like hate in my heart for those people at all. I just like think they shouldn't be catered to. Like, yes, there are going to be some people who have some, like, don't understand romance very well or whatever, but like, come on. Like, this has to be a video game, not a whatever simulator. And this was like, I think that there was very much a pandering thing there too.
For trannies. Dragon Age is a friendship simulator for trannies. Like, Rightoids have podcasts, trannies have Dragon Age.
Well, the thing is, they caught, actually, of course, Inquisition, the previous game, they caught a lot of shit because there was some, like, trans character, but that was, like, not in your, they couldn't be, like, I don't think they could be, like, an NPC in your party or whatever.
Group. The other thing about this, that was where I already kind of didn't like, I believe I had already turned down the difficulty because why bother? And then, yes, so what it is you have, and the Kunari, we could get just a little bit into the lore, just because it just goes to show you, again, this kind of total inability to get their story straight or even just care about the basics. Yes, there's this interesting race of, like, I don't know, like Tolkien Muslims. Like, if the, what are the, what is the, not the, the one in, there's like the space Jews in Mass Effect, right? So then,
yeah.
But now we have like the Tolkien Muslims are the Kunari, who have this holy text called the Kun. It's not the Quran, it's the Kun. And what's interesting is it's kind of pitched, like, so in the first game, you have a Kunari companion, but he's kind of just a big dude. And they don't really bring, he has like long braided hair, but he's kind of just a Viking phenotype. And there's nothing really special about him other than he's very gruff and keeps talking about his severe religious ideology or whatever. Apparently, there had always been a plan for the Kunari for this to be essentially an ethno-religion, and for the Kunari as a race, not just the people who believe in the Kun or practice it or whatever, but to be like kind of horned demon-looking guys, which is why the best thing about Dragon Age 2 and the thing that really sticks out of my memory is the Kunari. There's essentially this, it's a plot device, and there's this kind of ship full of Kunari that are just kind of hanging out all game, and they're kind of vaguely menacing, and it almost does a kind of anti-lib, as I recall, sort of subversion, where you expect, you know, these kind of weird looking outsiders with this weird religion who look like demons, and they're being actively discriminated against. They're not like allowed into the city proper. I would expect that to have been played as like, oh, and they're actually good all along. But in fact, they like essentially conduct a violent insurrection against their admitted, you know, openly shitty circumstances, and you have to essentially kill them all, or at least I did. So yes, then in the third game, you get another Kunari companion, this time, with horns, looks like the demon part, and except for he's like friendly and kind of vaguely gay, as I recall. There's like he's very much a bear. He's there for the bears, right? And he leads a mercenary company, and among this mercenary company, there is one. It's a woman who's doing the Brienne of Tarth bit from Game of Thrones. The woman who, except for I guess Brienne never claims to be a man. This is a full on female to male tranny, which you wouldn't even necessarily have noticed, except there's like dialogue in the game in Dragon Age 3, Inquisition, where essentially it's, I don't remember the, like 100%. This was where I like threw up my hands in disgust at the game, like once and for all, was basically this character, this, it's not even your party member. It's like a member of the mercenary company that like is commanded by your party member. He says like, oh, I grew up as a woman, but the people don't accept me as a man, even though I'm a man now. And Iron Bull, your Kunari party member, is like, you are a man. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. It's like, this is fucking bull. Like, are you fucking, like, what the fuck? So then there's a point in the game where you have the option to like, you can intervene or not as this mercenary company is in danger. They're like on a ship and being fired at. And I don't even remember what the like outcome, like the game gave you very weak in-game reasons why you might not want to save them, even though it really didn't cost you anything. clear implication was that you should save them. I was like, nah, that tranny's going straight to the bottom of the ocean. And then later on, basically your party member turns on you. Like it's to the point where if you didn't save his company, then he'll like fight you and you have to kill him and he dies and he's no longer in your party. Because the developers were big mad that you didn't save the so yeah, that's Dragon Age and has been for a very long time. So it is kind of interesting watching the, what did people expect exactly? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, the vibe you get is that they've actually just like, instead they've just stopped doing optional stuff that would like, there's no, basically you can't avoid the stuff now. Like
there's no option not to 46%.
The funny, the one thing was like, there was some character, it's just a screenshot that's come out from like the earlier reviewers. I guess it's out now, so it's not even a bargain anymore, but like, it was like some person saying like, I'm non-binary or whatever. And every dialogue option was like, yes. Like you couldn't be a hater.
Right. It's different ways of accepting. Like how emphatic do you want to be in your acceptance of this? That's the other thing.
It was I stand with you. We all stand with you. Everyone stands with you. Yes, I agree. I feel the same way. It was also like a...
Right. There is... That's the other thing I wanted to say or just occurred to me. There is tranny shit in this, starting with the first thing I knew about Veilguard, the new Dragon Age 4, the first screenshots in game that I ever saw were from the character creator having the option to put like top surgery scars.
Yeah, which is also which leaves open a hilarious bit that me and my buddy were talking about at we were hanging out because we were discussing Dragon Age and we're like, what if they actually used this system in a cool way where like every time you used a heal spell, your tits grew back?
Well, people were saying, I mean, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, the new Dungeons and Dragons apparently has a similar problem where not only have they gotten rid of any kind of racial bonuses. So it used to be that like, if you rolled an orc, you would have a bonus to strength, but a negative to intelligence, and elves would have bonus to intelligence. And I forget what the, whatever. Anyway, there were different racial characteristics. That's all gone. But in an effort to make the game inclusive to people with disabilities, they have essentially, as I understand it, bespoke rules for characters in wheelchairs, which include, as I understand it, in the whatever game manual for the new edition of Dungeons and Dragons, rules specifying that like druids, when druids transform, that their wheelchair transforms with them into like a smaller animal wheelchair. So like they transform into a bird. There's like a little bird wheelchair, I guess, hanging off the bird's belly as it flies around. Or I don't really know how that's.
That sounds like a Monty Python bit, dude. Holy shit.
Yeah, it really does. But yeah, so that's the.
An African swallow can carry two wheelchairs. Oh, sorry.
and these are the same people, right? These are like literally the exact same human being individuals who are like writing the Dungeons and Dragons rules and consulting for the shit. And yeah, so while there is some tranny shit in the game, and there, I guess as part of the character, like at the end of the character creation process, there's the whole, like, so you go through, and that was the other thing, I guess, I'm sure some people are already familiar, but for those who don't know, there was the whole kerfuffle on the internet because the first thing about the game to drop was the character creator. Not only are there options for top surgery scars, but the chest size slider is essentially broken. Like you cannot do booba. There are no, like you can put booba at 100% and booba at a 0%, and you go from like a B to like a C cup is the range. Not even, probably from like a it's really, which I mean, again, it's not the kind of thing, like I'm not a tranny, so I don't actually. I'm not like personally invested in making my 3D avatar have big tits. It's more like this is just an aggressive fuck you to just normal heterosexual male sexuality. Like to whatever extent actual normal heterosexual males would even care or would be doing that at all. It's just the idea in their head that like we don't want you making a character with big boobs that you can look at and get a sexual thrill from as a normal heterosexual, because they're just spiteful mutants, right?
Yep. RIP, big video game booba. Probably never coming back, to be honest with you, outside of like Asian games.
Did you see the Lara Croft? Like, they were talking about this on Tedious even. I guess Netflix has a new Tomb Raider series where Lara Croft has like no booba. It's like you know, flat chest. And the voice actress who's recording the voice for Lara Croft is like, I don't know, like triple E's or something. I don't know. That's just some massive mammaries. And what is it? The new Wolverine, like, I guess there's a new Wolverine game coming out where they turn Jean Grey fugly. It's like across the board. Nexus Mods. So Nexus Mods has, like, obviously, if you have a, like, you know, turn Fallout into all white people or turn Starfield into all white people, they won't host those kind of mods. But there were complaints, and I don't know if they actually took it down or not. But there was a weird looking into it from the moderating staff at Nexus Mods because of some mods being like, yeah, we're gonna make the women more attractive, like we're just gonna give them more feminine faces, like we're gonna make them more pleasing to look at. And Nexus Mods is like, I don't think so.
Well, one of the things that is like interesting in these, this, like, it's not just Dragon Age, is like, we have the documents to some degree, because like after these games fail, a lot of these people go unemployed, frankly, these artists, and they will like publish like their early concept work. And people have been doing these things with,
right? Yeah. Yes, and yes.
And it's like they start off as like hotter or whatever. And then like as the game development goes on, they get like uglied up in really weird ways. Like they get more mannish features and such, you know? Like it's a weird thing to watch.
Even early builds, not, you know, past the like initial concept art phase, will have often more attractive and more attractively proportioned female characters. And yeah, it's really wild what's going on. But to conclude what I was saying before, so you have like the character selector, the character creation bit, right? Where you if you're a female, you can't have tits or an ass. The ass slider is also broken. You have options for vitiligo, or I don't even know, how do you, is that how you pronounce it? I don't know. You like the Michael Jackson, you know, thing where your skin is like splotchy, which is an extremely rare genetic condition. I mean, we're talking like fractions of a percent of the population, but I guess it's the new fetish, because it was also, wasn't it also Concord had a character with vitiligo? Am I hallucinating that?
Yeah. What's funny is it's like increasingly incurable, which is very funny. As soon as there's more of like a treatments on the market now. Not that it's,
I'm sure there are. Not that it matters. there's treatments for not having your tits chopped off too, right? Which is keeping your tits. I don't know. So vitiligo, I guess, was like a thing on, I guess Tumblr doesn't exist anymore, but whatever.
Tumblr exists.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
So are they still on Tumblr,
I think so. There's still discourse on Tumblr. Yeah.
All right. So whatever, I guess vitiligo must have been big on Tumblr like a year or two, I'm assuming. And then yes, after you,
is it vitiligo? I thought it was vitiligo. Am I crazy?
I have no idea. That's what I was. I don't, could look it up, but pray. And anyway, so you have a checkbox for vitiligo or vitiligo. You have a checkbox for top surgery scars. You cannot, if you're female, make yourself have a big ass or big tits. And then when you're all done and you've created your freakish tranny monstrosity, the game asks you like point blank, are you actually a tranny or not? And I saw this there was a PC Gamer article. Let me pull it up, because this is, I don't know. Did you see this? It was praising the game for like how it was separating your trans identity from your trans body features, because these are
So there's a term for this in the community. It's called being stealth. If you actually just like pass as a tranny,
oh my god!
And you can just, you know, they're called stealth. So like, I don't like a transsexual person who like just says, oh, I'm a man because they've like can pass or whatever, is a different thing than someone who's like, I'm a trans man. I believe that's what they're representing here.
Yeah, no, it's like you can have all the tranny shit, but not identify as a tranny is the basic idea. And this is like a Okay, yeah, here we go. PC Gamer article titled, "Here's exactly how the transgender and non-binary options in Dragon Age the Veilguard work." And that's where I was going with this, is that, like, much even more so than tranny, like, the thing, this game seems to be for the what is the NBs, they call it, yes, the non-binaries. Dragon Age the Veilguard is coming out, and being one of the big RPG releases this year, quite a few of us have been sinking our teeth into it. Blah, blah, blah. I'm here to shed some light and clear up some confusion. Here's the skinny on exactly how the... you might have noticed a few... If you've been following the wider response in hubbub, I skipped over this, you might have noticed a few disjointed screenshots discussing the trans and non-binary options in the game. I'm here to shed some light and clear up some confusion. Here's the skinny on how exactly they work. First up, in a move I think is actually pretty neat for roleplay purposes, your identity and pronouns are completely separate on character creation. Now, my understanding, having seen this, obviously I'm not going to buy or play this game, is that, like, everybody has to select pronouns. Like, it's just part of the character creation process. Like, even if you could be he, him, or she, they, or whatever the fuck, but it's like you have to select pronouns in order to finish creating your character, is my understanding. Do you know if that's true or not?
Dude, I honestly, I wouldn't have bought this game if the reviews were fucking fire. It's Dragon Age.
So the major thing I'd like to clear up here is that, contrary to some rumors about these pronoun options or the top scar customization option irreversibly making your character transgender, these things don't impact your character's identity at all beyond naturally the words the characters you refer to them. Instead, it's all handled in a very early game cutscene. When Rook's getting set up in their digs for the first time, they'll interact with a hand mirror. During this dialogue, you'll get one of several options, some of which lock in your character's trans or non-binary identity, regardless of the options you picked at character creation. These are clearly and coherently signposted on the wheel, so there's no danger of selecting one by accident. So they have separate options for trans and non-binary, which are on the character creation. And so, I mean, it's, yeah. And speaking of, 100,000 or so trannies or non-binaries that they made this game for, the... So when it came out of the gate, there were, both sides were kind of crowing. At first, it didn't seem like it was going to be such a great launch, and then it quickly had about 50,000 players within like an hour or less, which isn't huge, but is respectable. And the main thing was that it was growing very quickly. So there was a lot. Oh, and the other thing was that it was the number one seller on Steam for a while. It might still be. Which the trannies on Twitter were very excited about, and they kept saying, like, go. There was a lot of dunking on get woke, go broke discourse, which we know isn't true. Of course, it's not. You know, that's a kind the kind that that's it's not exactly true. The get woke, go broke, and that's not my critique of the game exactly. But anyway, the thing is that it doesn't actually take all that many units moved to reach the top spot on Steam comparatively. I mean, that's not,
but not
doesn't
really also tell you. It's a lot easier pre-Thanksgiving, right? Like, that's,
yes,
yes, it's coming in before the big like holiday releases. So
that's exactly right. Yes, this is a kind of empty launch window. There's nothing else really competing with it. I guess there's the new Call of Duty, but that's on a completely different, like, that's on a different launch. I don't even think they're on, is that on Steam at all? I'm not sure. I know it used to not be.
I don't know.
Doesn't matter. So it climbed and then it plateaued at about 70,000, and it sat there, and then it went down, and now it's climbing as of this recording. We're hovering right below the 24-hour peak of 70,414 current users on Steam, which is also, as of now, the all-time peak. And I don't know if they're going to break 100,000 concurrent users on Steam ever, all-time. I doubt it. I get their only shot, really, I would think, is this weekend. But notice, while we're doing, it's called A-logging. I do a little bit of A-logging. Baldur's Gate 3 by Larian, of course, now no longer a BioWare joint. It's different. The studio that did Divinity Original almost immediately hit like 750,000. And then they actually didn't peak until two weekends after release. They, you know, of course, there was some day-night cycle up and down, but it was a pretty consistent rise. for Baldur's Gate 3 to about 850,000 peak concurrent max on, I mean, of course, a big budget for Larian, but nothing compared. I mean, I'd be shocked if it was even a quarter of the budget of this game. It's probably closer to a tenth. We don't know console numbers. And as I understand it, if you're a pay pig to EA and you have their like most expensive monthly subscription tier, and this is included with that, but that's not it's not exactly a profit sale for BioWare either, well, right?
Also, I just want to mention that Dragon Age Inquisition did, even though it was like really bad, it kind of was a perfect, there wasn't many, it was like, I believe it was one of the first like not launch games on the new console generation, and it sold like gangbusters actually. Yes. Because it got very lucky in its window. It sold like 12 million copies and did oversell like internal estimates even. I'm seeing analytics saying this is like has sold like 200,000 so far.
Oof.
But that, you know, that's probably just pre-orders
though. Really? The thing is like games, I don't know, the landscape has changed even in the time that we've been doing this show, which is not very long. And obviously it's a completely different world from 2014 when Inquisition launched. Yeah.
They also have the live services that cannibalize your sales, like the EA live service, whatever, does cannibalize sales. Like that's not,
well, that's what it's there for, is like you have this idea in your mind, like, okay, I'm paying whatever it is, $240 a year to EA, but I would have bought Dragon Age for $80 and now I get to play it quote unquote for free. So that's already like a third of my yearly subscription just in this one game. So I have to imagine that's, that's essentially your thought process for the Xbox, right? Or at least to some extent.
Yeah. That's about what it is. Now it was currently sitting at, it's very hard to get numbers on these early, but my prediction was it wouldn't break 2 million total. Yeah, it might not.
That's looking like a good prediction. You don't think? You think? Well, sorry, go on.
Well, it had a lot of Steam has a list of like before games release, like what are the most pre-ordered games? Because Steam keeps a lot of its numbers public, and it was third place.
But how much? But that's like, again, that's pre-orders. Like that's just not gonna, like how many, who the pre-orders? You might even be too young for this. Pre-orders are from the days of like, you wanted to get the gold N64 cartridge for Zelda Ocarina of Time, but there was no pre-order system. So,
well, no, pre-orders were for when you were legit concerned, like the Call of Duty might be sold out, like Black Ops might be sold out.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is like that made sense in an era of physical cartridges, for an era of physical CDs. But pre-orders for CD, I mean, I remember, I think the last game I ever pre-ordered was Warcraft 3. And when I went to go pick it up at Best Buy or whatever, there was just a pile because it's a fucking CD. Like, it, you know, I mean, it's just, there was no point. And digital pre-orders is just retarded. Like, I really have to question the IQ of someone who pre-orders it. I guess maybe if there's some pre-order bonus that you really, really want, but all that shit comes in the Game of the Year edition anyway. So I don't know, whatever. Bottom line, like, it's just I can't imagine it's many people. And of those people, you would expect certain, if you're like that invested in Dragon Age, so you're pre-ordering it on Steam, I have to imagine you're playing it literally the minute it's released. So all those people, like, that's also probably the only people.
So the number one pre-ordered game at the same time was Call of Duty, obviously, through Steam numbers. The second one was, and this may actually spell not so great news for this thing game, because like third highest pre-order kind of doesn't matter who you're behind, right?
Yeah.
So the second one was Sonic X Shadow Generations.
Okay.
Which, I mean, yes, there's a lot of Sonic fans, but like, I don't feel like,
I hear the numbers, okay, like, of Sonic.
If you told me Sonic was beating Mass Effect 4, I would be worried, right?
You know, here's the thing is, I think the numbers for Sonic are inflated, so... people need to look up. Sonic. I had to. I'm sorry.
What happened to free will, DK? What happened to free will?
Anyway, I don't know. It's a guessing game, and I wouldn't. It's tea leaf reading, and doesn't. You know, they're never gonna. The verification will be when the layoffs hit, right? Like that's
also BioWare has been dead since the doctors left. Yeah. And then the doctors, yeah, like number two guys all left like within the next 5 years. It's not a, yeah, it's just company, not BioWare. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had hoped that perhaps like the Mass Effect 3 team knew what the fuck they were doing. Cause I actually am not a hater of that product. It was a very well-made game.
Well, that's a prime example of like, I think they leaked, like, I think what happened there is the, whatever team or individuals were assigned to the side quests on 3 were clearly the most competent and probably had the closest connection to the studio as it had existed. And so when the feedback for 3 from the people who actually enjoyed it was, yeah, the ending sucked and there were problems with the narrative arc, but man, you know, they really delivered on closing up all these arcs that had been set up over the past 2 games. And that's true. They did a great, especially, you know, the Solarian and all this kind of stuff was they had, there was a lot of gold in the shit pile. So I think they took that and they learned the wrong lesson from it, which was, they tried to lean in on into that as a marketing strategy, as a, not just marketing, but like strategic direction. It was just, no, you fucking morons. Like, everybody wanted the narrative arc to be good. The side quest shouldn't eclipse the main story. It's just, that was the actually good part of the game. You idiot. You fucking moron.
Well, that was also always the good part of the game, right? Like Mass Effect 2, the best game in the franchise, in my opinion, is just side, yeah, quests. There's like, yes, 4 main missions, yeah, in the whole game,
yeah, that's
right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
It's literally all side quests. Yes. But I like that the, how do you say? Like, I had some level of hopes because when Mass Effect 3 came out, I literally enjoyed the experience of playing it. Like, the actual gameplay is very good. And I was like, well,
the
wow.
Was the best in the series. Yeah, no, me too. I mean,
I was like, EA took over this company. Now it's fully, like, you know, been Borg. Right. 2 was obviously an EA product, but, you know, it wasn't fully like Borg EA assimilated. Yeah. But, like, they kept like the BioWare-ness of the stuff, but they also said, no, we're going to spend a lot of fucking money and make the combat in here feel really fucking good. Like as good as Gears of War. Right.
And I've never played Anthem, but from what I understand,
ass.
Okay. Sorry, so no, it's fine. But if you did play,
no, it's not fine. It's ass.
Okay.
Sorry.
But the combat, from what I understand, it was a refinement of the combat in Mass Effect 3. Is that not accurate?
I would not go that far. It,
okay.
It was, I don't know, it's hard to explain how bad that game is and like why it's just not compelling.
I never played it.
It's doing like a movement okay, so the combat is very like not super complex, obviously, but a lot of the thing the game is doing is like kind of similar to like the original Mass Effect 1, like traversal things in the tank. Like you've got to solve puzzles with like you're jumping around and like learning how to fly, but like the ability to fly doesn't really seem to affect like the actual combat. Like once you're in combat, it's kind of like you can jump around, but you can't like fly everywhere. So like you're in these caves, like solving puzzles by flying and stuff, and it's just not fun. And then and it doesn't really link up.
Yeah,
Why
would I? Why would you want to do that?
Yeah, and the story is dumb too. Like I don't know, it's like a weird
thing I heard about the story. Yeah, it was basically like a J.J. Abrams mystery box, but even dumber.
Well, it can't decide if it's like a fantasy or a sci-fi thing, you know. What a dumb game, dude. It fucking sucked. I was so pissed. Anthem was bad, dude. I had high hopes.
Well, I think ultimately what this does is it, I mean, essentially, certainly everything past Mass Effect 3, and then also the
Inquisition. Inquisition was beloved, but by who is kind of like, I don't know. It was one of those like Avatar type movies or games where like it made a bunch of money, but has almost no staying power. Mm-hmm. Culturally, like when Mass Effect did, right? So I don't
which
know.
Was hilarious when like the what is an anti whatever like the opposite of the anti woke. So you have like the anti woke A-logs, right, on Twitter, especially in the gaming sphere, like the Quartering and Metacur. I actually haven't seen them on this. I haven't looked for it. The main.
Well, they're all like Trump fags now, right? There's all Trump.
Yeah. Oh no, that's what I'm saying. Is they're all 100% in on Trump. A lot of crossover, obviously, also with the like the Disney A-log community. Which is why it sort of makes my skin crawl a little bit when I'm like, I am actually emotionally invested. Like I want to see this game fail. It makes me happy that it seems to be flopping, but it's also like that puts me uncomfortably adjacent to the Disney A-log types. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's whatever. I kind of want to change gears to talk about the action. There is some consequence to this.
Okay.
So there was a fake that came out that I do think is fake. That was a fake leak. But IGN in some kind of article said there was basically the reviewers were given this. There's this like non-binary quest line that's like apparently very cringe, and it was under NDA. Like the reviewers were not allowed to talk about it. Like they were trying to
talk about this because it's even worse than you think, and worse than I realized until essentially this morning. So yes, there is fairly early on in the game. You have a Kunari companion one of the things about the, I actually skipped over that line in the PC Gamer article I was reading earlier too, but the Kun, this text has some kind of, it's very gender binary. It's very like men are men and do men stuff and women are women and do women's. That's explicit in the first game, to the point where there were some funny screenshots floating around of Sten, your Kunari companion, who just he's genetically looks like he was born in human. He was a human, but he's just a follower of the Kun. Anyway, he's saying like basically a bunch of things that nowadays are interpreted would be interpreted very much as kind of anti-tranny or even just, you know, sexist in a kind of classical way. So in the new Dragon Age Veilguard, there's a Kunari that you meet that's a female Kunari, but Kunari society, she doesn't like, I guess, Kunari society because it's so gender constrictive because of this religious text that they have. And she identifies as non-binary. She's not a tranny. She's non-binary. And I had seen, yes, it was, and BioWare and EA were actively sending out cease and desist to people who were putting, so the quest line is to convince her family to accept her non-binary identity. And like the screenshot of like the absolute nadir of the cringe is she's she they now. I'm she they. Basically, it's like telling off the parents of this party member of yours that they have to accept her non-binary identity. Anyway, I looked into it because I saw, so there was a basically the name of that quest line involves hatching. It's called, hatching the dragon or something like this. It's a direct reference to the egg cracking thing, which I found extremely disturbing. Like it's not just that they're injecting this shit into your video games. It's literally they're like incorporating the internal terminology of the people who are actively trying to turn your children into gay faggot trans.
Yeah, no, I mean it's what it is. It's always been like, and there's also the HR clip that was like explaining like what to do if you misgender somebody. Like this shit, it's very cringe, dude. I'm running out of gas on
yeah,
Dragon.
No, that's fine. We can move on. I just it was like a little dragon hatches. A little dragon hatches is the name of the quest line where you encourage Tosh to crack her egg, her non-binary egg. Yeah. yeah, I don't know. I can't wait for the layoffs. I hope they're epic. I hope the studio closes. I don't think we'll be so lucky, at least not anytime soon. But who knows? I mean, it depends on... I think, though, that there's enough, like...
Mass Effect 3 and Dragon Age Inquisition made a lot of fucking money.
Right? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they can afford to release bombs for a while, like an alarming amount of time.
I don't think that BioWare. The thing is, EA. Like at this point, what does EA have to gain? Like they could fire every single person involved with BioWare the studio, keep the name, have them do nothing but release patches for Mass Effect Legendary Edition for like Windows 15.
Oh, which also made a fuck ton of money. Jesus.
Right. Oh yeah. So like, there's like. And that's it. Like they don't need to develop. They could just keep the back catalog relevant and working fine on new computers for whatever year's value of new computers. And keep the
no.
Like,
we
the
need
brand.
To have we need to have Mass Effect 4, and it's got to be dog shit. Like oh that's.
I guess they're active, and they are actively working on it, aren't they? So I've seen like first they were like, "Oh, we're not going to do it," and then like, "Well, yeah, we are." Oh God.
Like it has to be dog shit. I think it's I think that might like. Mass Effect has a lot of goodwill built up. I think it's the best trilogy on the. Well, actually, it's a that's best of its generation. Like, it was a unique in that it all came out on the same consoles, right, cycle. So like a lot of people played that. Man, it's gonna be dog shit, yeah. Dude.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question. It's I can only imagine what horrors they have in store. Oh, the game director for the new Mass Effect got out in front of the bad press for Veilguard. He was like, because that was the other thing was, I mean, the art style, right? Went from, okay, whatever problems you want to have, or you can, before the first Dragon Age even came out, people were making fun of, I guess they had like a Marilyn Manson track in the background. They were obviously playing up from the kind of pre-release trailers, dark and gritty. Yes, but like in very much in keeping with the kind of Song of Ice and Fire type, I don't know if you call it with like gritty high fantasy or low fantasy with, I don't know how you'd describe it, but in any case, going for a realistic dark and gritty art style to like, literally this is a Marvel comic book cartoon. It's like, I don't know who is this for? Like, I guess the 100,000 trannies that are playing it right now, 70,000.
Auto-gynophiles? I don't know. It's a rough market to break into.
You said a new all-time peak 4 minutes ago of 70,457.
That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of players.
Concurrent. I mean, that's not nothing, but it's not. I don't know. I don't think they're gonna shift. Not counting EA subscriber.
Also just Steam though too. There's like other consoles, right? So
I know, but that's what I'm saying. Counting other consoles, but not counting subscribers like that. I don't think they're gonna hit 2 million. Well, we'll see. I guess I don't think we're ever gonna know for sure. Again, we'll know when the layoffs hit. But even there, EA is enormous and BioWare is in some ways too big to fail.
Yeah, I would be. So, I don't know. Like they're gonna. The fall of we've done a whole episode for those gears on the back catalog on like the rise and fall of BioWare.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And it's in the back catalog if you could find it. But
it's wow. There.
Like
it's extremely
what a fall off. Like
yeah,
what a depressing game. What a depressing company and game and like. Like truly wearing the skin suit in a way that I don't think any other, like for all their flaws, like Blizzard is still like Blizzardy, right? Like
yes.
there's some continuity. There's some people who stayed on, maybe like there's some higher ups that are still the same. Bro, BioWare just like you can't see any continuity of like really anything. And like I have this problem that I've noticed with like certain movies, like A24 is really bad for this. Even though I actually enjoy like A24's films, they're well made. But BioWare has the same problem where, like, the people creating the current thing are fans of, like, older stuff in the... Like, they're fans of older BioWare games, so they're kind of, like, aping the style. And it creates, like, some weirdness. Like, the HR briefing on, like, if you misgender somebody is, like, told in the perspective of, oh, this funny story of this officer who used to be in our, like, mercenary band. Is like it's told with that thing, which is also like how 95% of Mass Effect lore is explained. Like, oh, well, we had a guy in our unit, and you're just like hanging out and talking about like trading war stories with like NPCs, right? And it's good. It's fun. I fell for it. I liked it. It's a good way of creating like a world. But when they utilize like that kind of like tool for like actually like you should be here's how to show you're sorry for misgendering someone. I was like, oh, maybe that stuff wasn't actually that good. I just like fell for it really hard, you know. Like, mm-hmm. It exposes like the because they're like aping the old style. It exposes like poorly. They expose like weaknesses in the actual quality of the writing of those games somewhat. Like, it does kind of damage it. Like when A24 films, like the way they do horror and like the way they really really overuse like tension music in the style of like an old school horror film. You're like, oh wait. Is any of this scary or is this just a tense classical music piece with a lot of violin, you know, like it exposes like that older yeah. stuff might actually yeah, be bad yeah, yeah. too, you know, that's yeah. how I felt like watching that clip of the misgender briefing. I was like, oh shit. Like maybe BioWare was never actually good. I was just young yeah. and stupid and like credulous. It's like, oh no, bro. Content for, I don't know who's playing this game. I'm not going to, it's not worth pirating. It's not worth whatever. You know what? Good news. We're transitioning. I haven't played a lot of video games because we haven't been checking in a while. Sure. If you like, if we talk about FTL, one of my favorite games, one of your favorite games.
Oh, yes.
There's a new FTL out. It's basically an FTL mod, whatever you want to call it.
It's a darker, grittier FTL.
Well, it's like it's using like first edition Warhammer 40K aesthetics, like Rogue Trader stuff, if you're into that, instead of like Star Trek aesthetics. It's very good. It's very similar to FTL. Different. I mean, it's like a kind of a spiritual successor or an homage or whatever. It's like $15. It's fucking great. I play the shit out of it. I played it. It's got it starts off easy and gets harder every run. Right, if you beat the run, I have now beaten the hardest run level. Torment 12. I'm enjoying the crap out of that game. That's a good game. Two man team. Very enjoyable. Also, new MechWarrior 5 is out. I'm playing a little bit of that. Not as much because it's not quite as enjoyable as Void War.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it's acceptable. It is. I have not gotten too deep into it. It is doing an interesting thing with the setting of MechWarrior, which is it's set in the Clan Invasion, which is the it's part where like the return of like the exiles into the galaxy, basically from like the previous almost like legendary era civil war, and they have better tech and all this stuff. And they've like created a new culture because they were out in like deep space forever. And it's like but you're playing as them instead of against them in the traditional MechWarrior way you would kind of do this. Although not anymore, because there's been a lot of games, you know, playing as clanners. But you play as clanners, but they're not like, I have lore issues because the clanners don't behave very clanny, because they're supposed to be like basically like eugenic space fascists who are very arrogant. And you play as like the young rookie unsure of themselves team, which like doesn't exist in that setting. And also,
lore autism is my favorite genre of geek. Please continue.
But I do want to stop that. I do think that.
No, I mean, 100% serious. This is great.
But it is, if you like MechWarrior 5, it is essentially more MechWarrior 5 with a single player like narrative and management element, as opposed to a open world like, or open map like mission taking element. It's good enough. It's just not. I don't like being it locked, like that game locked you into certain ways of playing MechWarrior 5, and it's got the like your AI teammates fucking suck problem. And it's supposed to be a very like team focused game. You have to either babysit your guys a bunch or not have fun, or you can just try to I'm good at MechWarrior 5, like just be really good at the game and try to like win, and faster than your teammates can like get all their arms blown off. So it's got MechWarrior 5 problems, but I like MechWarrior 5 and can deal with those problems. It's just not as enjoyable as FTL. It's what it is.
40k FTL.
Yes, 40k FTL. Void War. Very good. It's in pre-alpha stage, so you have to be a little bit savvy to know how to find it on, I think, tundraitch.io or one of these like, you know, alpha sites that basically, it's like Steam, but, or like, it's like good old games, but they don't charge you to update your game. You can just keep releasing new patches. So it's not in a good enough state to like release on Steam, because they patch it every 5 days. But it's very playable, and I'm very ahead of the curve on. I got very lucky finding it. I think it's totally playable. I think they should release it like now, but they still want to make it better. And I think they do want to make it. As far as I can tell, it is very FTL looking. I think they want to kind of obscure how FTL it is, even though that's like the part that I enjoy, is that it's just more FTL and harder. But whatever. There's some quality of life.
Harder than FTL.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it starts off easy, though. It's very smart how they get you into it. Because, like, you literally can't play on the hard modes until you, like, beat several runs of increasing difficulty, right? So you will taste success before you get into, like, the true game, if you will. So you know what, like, it looks like to win. Whereas FTL started off normal FTL run, you might not get to the boss. Right. Your first run on this.
You might not get through the first
couple sectors. The first sector you should win, unless you're like brain dead. But this game, you will, if you put any FTL, you should get to the final boss.
It took me a few FTL runs to get to the FTL boss.
Yeah. If you've played any FTL at all, you should, your first run on the easy difficulty, you should get to the boss. Maybe you don't beat him, but you definitely should get there.
Okay.
Yeah. Great game.
Speaking of 40k in games, we have a little. I saw that it was on sale and I've been meaning to play for a while. I picked up Battle Sector 40k for $5 and have enjoyed it. There was a particularly annoying mission that I hit, where like every preceding mission I had to it was a certain kind of established rules, and then they kind of threw them all in a very shitty way with an ambush that suddenly squads were being wiped in one hit before I had a chance to do anything at all. And I was like, okay, nothing in the game up to this point has given me reason in the single player campaign. But it has given me reason to expect that on the table. But other than that, And in general, it's
wait, how did I miss this game? Holy shit.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's basically
like a turn-based 40K game.
I've never played tabletop. I don't know if I ever will, but from what people are saying that it's almost a conceptually faithful adaptation of tabletop. It has
by Slytherin too. So it's pretty good.
Yes. Yep. And no, it's like
as how did I not know this game? Holy shit. I play every 40K game.
As a tactical strategy game, it is quite good. And it's you know, it works well, and you clearly get a sense of, you know, what how it's supposed to be. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks really good. Do you ever play Mechanicus? I know you said you downloaded it.
I got it for free at some point, and I have it installed. I just haven't had a chance to play it yet. I mentioned it also because you said you hit a similarly frustrating difficulty spike, and I was curious if you ever got over it.
No, but that's because Void War came out, and like I've been playing. I don't play video games this month. I've been playing Void War. Yeah, like I'm sorry, right. It's really good.
Right. Yeah.
Also, it's like cool. I get the because it's so early, you can like get in the Discord and talk to the devs. It's like a 2-man team. Like when a bug or something like that, like, you know, hey, I'm getting like crashes when I do this. Like, oh yeah, here, unequip X Y Z thing, you know, and it fixes it temporarily. You know, like they're I'm not like a QA tester, but I'm feeling the
de facto. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, no, it's very enjoyable. Void War, big fan. Also, if you feel like that, if you like that 40K, like early 40K, like heavy metal aesthetic, it's cool.
Yes, and definitely check out Battle. I think you'd like Battle Second.
Probably, yeah.
I mean, it's you know, rough edges, cuts both ways, but yeah. So did you want to talk about Russia, Ukraine, or did you?
I have a theory I want to slide by you, guy.
Okay.
So, Secretary Blinken is basically flying to, every 2 weeks he flies to Tel Aviv, and they do the bit, right? And he like, and when he says, and I'm stealing this take from a friend of ours, he knows who he is. Like when Secretary Blinken went to the table in the War Cabinet and said, "I'm not here as a American, I'm here as a Jew." You remember that?
Yes. Yep.
He red-pilled me on this statement. He is not saying like, "Oh, I stand with Israel." He is making a status claim that he's not like he represents a certain faction of like the New York Times type Zionists. He's saying, "I'm not an American who will do whatever you say. Yes, sir. No, sir. I'm a Jew.
I'm a stakeholder. Americans are pigs, but I'm a Jew, therefore I'm a stakeholder.
Yeah. I get to disagree with you, right?" And that's a powerful claim. And my thing was, well, what if Blinken or what if like Kamala Harris loses the election, right? And Trump's going to put in some like either hyper Chabadnik or just some Christian Zionist fucking mouth breather or John Boltonite, right? As Secretary of Defense, who will just give Netanyahu whatever he wants. But Blinken still represents like that faction, right? Of like he is the Blinken is the personification of a certain faction of like, you know,
he's a Soros guy, like in the
Zionists who can breathe through their nose, you know, like that kind of guy, like Zionists are not just mouth breathers. And I have this theory that if Trump wins, Blinken, the private citizen, will keep like flying to Tel Aviv every 2 weeks because he's become the representative of that whole faction.
Oh, that is a hot take. Yeah,
that's my prediction.
Yes. No, if not he himself, I'm sure they're in very
well. The thing is, he is the organization of all those like people. They all talk to him, and like he gets that information to
clearly the War Cabinet. American Jewry, especially of the like secular New York money Jew, as opposed to the like the tunnel Jew. He's their point guy. I mean, he's Secretary of State. Like, that's.
I don't want to go as far as to say that he would remain an interim Secretary of State for a while, before Trump like appointed a new guy. Yeah, but he might. Like, that's at least maybe longer than you would expect. But like,
would anyone be surprised?
I mean, he would have an interim. Maybe he'd take. I don't think he would take a deputy position. I don't think you can take a lower position. I mean, you can like legally, but I don't think it's like acceptable to become Deputy Secretary of State afterwards or return to the bureaucracy. Yeah.
Well, he'll go on some NGO or whatever.
Yeah, and he'll be like, he'll be still taking those plane flights to Tel Aviv every 2 weeks, you know.
Yeah,
and probably still talking to the War Cabinet.
As a member of like the American
private citizen. I'm a private citizen.
Because
I was thinking about what changes in Israel, and obviously it'd be easier if the Netanyahu faction wanted to like, oh, we're not going to talk to you. You're not going to Secretary of State, right? They could just like not talk to him, but I think they will because like Israel is a joint project at the end of the day, right? Like it's not.
They can't. Yeah, I mean Netanyahu. I guess that's maybe the way to read the tea leaves for the election is to whatever extent it's meaningful at all as a reflection of the internal Israeli political split between the BB guys and the labor Zionist guys. It's an interesting question because BB is in an interesting spot. Like he's in a very precarious position, and it's not clear to me how he's going to get out of it. But it's also not clear to me if or when he's going to exit the prime minister's life. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, it gets into some weirdness of like, also, like, the invasion of Lebanon has like officially stalled, right? Like, they're talking about declaring
victory and going home, which, I mean, okay. But yeah,
they're trying to spin up a sectarian thing in, like, they're basically, the deal that was offered, like, the ceasefire with the Lebanese government, I don't even know if it's how real it is. Like, the leaked agreement was like,
I just have to assume that's like, my assumption for that was that it was something that was provided to the press by the Israeli side to be reported in the press. I see no indication that this was.
Well, the deal is retarded. It's basically like, we stop bombing your country.
It's insultingly retarded, which is why I have to assume it was never actually even submitted to the Lebanese.
Well, like, in the exchange, you will start a civil war with Hezbollah. Like, you, the Lebanese government, will start a civil war with Hezbollah in exchange for us
doing what we're doing anyway. Like, I mean, it's just, yes, but there's also, I mean, again, there's no indication.
Also, do you honestly think, like, no, this is why it's very stupid. Do you think the Lebanese armed forces, which are not super, like, as a force on the ground, super Zionist sympathetic, right? Like, maybe there are some officers or whatever who are shitty. But Hezbollah just beat the IDF. Like, beat them, pretty much. I mean, they can keep pushing, maybe look like more of a draw. But, like, as it stands, Hezbollah just defeated the IDF. Do you think the Lebanese armed forces is, like, a more capable force than the IDF?
Well,
the fuck?
Well, what I think, part of what's going on, I think, is on all sides, there's a kind of, or I should say, on all sides inside Israel and in the American kind of political sphere, Trump is another great example of this, is like 1980s, like people are stuck in the 80s and early 90s, just generally. And even to the extent that where there's some kind of like, Trump 2016 was trying to break out of that mold, and that was quickly nipped in the bud. And now there's not even talk. I mean, we are fully back to like the Trump campaign 2024, I guess, is like maybe a little more overtly gay than Reagan could have gotten away with. But beyond that, it's just it's like 1986 all over again. And that's, I think that's true of just the kind of the people who actually have real systemic power are 70 and 80 years old, Mitch McConnell type people, right? Who just their brains froze. And in like 1986, 1988, something like that. And they've just never, ever updated their firmware, and they're never going to update. And so, yes.
But what do you mean Israel lost? But I gave Israel the weapons.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And but we gave you the JDAMs. Like, that's literally like the...
Do you understand? You can guide it from the air to the actual specific building that you want to explode. Isn't that cool? Not everyone can do that.
What if Israel lost the war? But I gave you the JDAMs. Like, it's literally, it's the did you eat breakfast question of, like, foreign policy.
Yes. And so if this had been, I think, proposed in 1988, I think it might have been a very attractive deal to the Lebanese government. And I think there's a pretty good chance that the Lebanese government in 1988 or even 1998 could have done pretty well against Hezbollah. Obviously, that time is now minimum 20 years, probably closer to 40 years in the past. But that until the boomer claw grip on power, until it is removed forcibly from their dead hands, because that's what's going to take is dying of old age. None of this is going to change. Yeah.
And it's weird. You see like how ossified the brains are even of like the Xers who come up in the system, right? It's not just the boomer.
Oh, yeah. Like,
Zihan, right? Peter Zihan is not, I believe he's an Xer. I don't think he's not that old. I mean,
to an extent, it's not, yes, but there is a kind of, and they talk about this, of course, it's not like you literally have to be whatever that even means.
Yeah, boomer, yeah.
It's a kind of spiritual archetype. And you do see it somewhat there is a younger contingent, but by and large, Zoomers have their own issues. But this kind of...
I got 99 problems and Zionism ain't one, nigga.
Yeah. Especially not like 1980s Reaganite vintage shit. It's like no one gives the... whatever your ideology or lack thereof as a Zoomer, whatever your other problems, you just do not have this yeah, that particular brain worm. Yeah. So there is a kind of generational component. Zion, I think, is a good example of, yes, it's people, maybe he's like in his 50s or something. So he's not a literal boomer. In that sense, just a spiritual boomer. And but yeah, one beholden to this particular brainworm. And yeah, that's the thing, is we're in uncharted territory. I think it's going to that's what I was saying before. I don't know, certainly in the post Six-Day War history, I mean, or just generally, like, where is the precedent in Israeli history for the situation with Netanyahu? Is there even anyone who's capable of whole, like, for all his problems and all, like, I don't even just mean from our perspective. I mean, if you're Jewish, you're an Anthony Blinken type Jew. You have problems with Netanyahu, right? Obviously, but like, literally, who is going to do a better job just holding Israel together?
Also, so during remember Netanyahu got very lucky last time they did this adventure in Lebanon. You know, as like the Buffalo Bills, they just get to Lebanon and they, like, it's the Super Bowl, right? They just can't fucking finish. They're going to be 0-4 now, I think, by the count. But anyway, Netanyahu got very lucky that in the Lebanon War, it was Ariel Sharon or Ehud Olmert. Like, they were it was that brief window where Netanyahu wasn't prime minister. And that did destroy, like, the quote, have you heard of this? The left, like, the left in Israel was arguably destroyed by the Lebanon invasion. Like, they weren't, like, the narrative was like, oh, well, if it was BB, we could have pulled this thing off, right? And obviously, that's not true, right? Obviously, the army wouldn't have performed better, but whatever. But there's something to be said for that being a bullet that he dodged. That was a career ender for Ariel Sharon, right? I believe.
That was it. I mean, he was also old at that point.
Yeah.
But that was it. Yeah, there's no, I don't know. I mean, it's I think that's what, to me, gets me, I don't know, worried is not exactly the right word, but I think the danger of the present moment is precisely in the lack of precedent and the, guardrails that have been in place since 1945. Obviously we chafe under the world order established at that moment in time, and it's not that I'm sad to see it go, but it is just objectively, it's also retarded. I guess that's the main thing for me, is like, Israel is behaving like a spoiled, retarded.
I'm sorry. I need to fact check myself. So no, I was lying with agenda. Ariel Sharon had his stroke prior to the war. It was Ehud Olmert, who was like his number two guy. He was designated. He was the acting prime minister after Sharon's stroke. Sorry, but who ever heard of Ehud Olmert? Right, no one, because Lebanon war fucking destroyed his career. Right, it's what it is.
Yes.
I wanted to make sure I wasn't lying with agenda.
So, but it doesn't really, obviously, it doesn't change the point, which is like, I guess one way of looking at this is Ariel Sharon slaughtered Palestinian civilians at Sabra and Shatila. He's a war criminal. He was a terrible person, et cetera. He wasn't incompetent, and he didn't lead Israel. Like, his war crimes were committed while he was a general commanding an army. That's shitty, but it's not unprecedented. The actions that he took as Israeli PM, and then Olmert and all these people took, the way that Israel conducted itself, again, I'm just pointing out, like, to the extent that Israel was a bad actor on the world stage during the early 2000s and late 90s, et cetera, it was also just a very different situation in terms of the unique position of its protector, the United States. They could get away with it. And they also just weren't as retarded. I mean, that's I really do think there's something to this argument of, like, as the Mizrahi population in Israel explodes, the average IQ plummets, and Israel, they just act increasingly retarded. We're just obviously seeing that. But when you have 400-ish years of a general world order and then 75 years of a particularly elaborate world order operating within that framework, and then you have this, like, this rogue state upending everything and actively shitting on the rules, the rule book, and the referees and the table, it's just like, what do you do with that?
Well, I think the answer is, when you blame Netanyahu and you scapegoat him and he steps down, but he doesn't seem to want to do that at all. And
Well, no, everyone, because the instant he does, he has all these legal, I mean, he will, I don't know if he'll be put in jail, but he will be prosecuted. He will like have to pay legal bills. He'll, you know, he will live certainly the next decade under a very thick, personally dangerous legal cloud. It may end up with him, I mean, I don't know, in exile in America.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. He's not going to be Miami. In jail. Of course not. Yeah, my, that's what I'm saying. Like a condo in Miami. I, you know, not the worst circumstance, but a fall.
Him and Zelensky in their condos, yeah. Matching condos in Boca Raton or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And their fellowships at like Brown University, foreign policy desk. So, yeah.
But that doesn't save Israel, I guess is my point. That doesn't like rescue Israel's geopolitical position. That doesn't murder a million Palestinians, you know? Like it doesn't accomplish any of their goals.
Yeah, and also there's like the clock. Dude, the clock is ticking till Ben-Gvir becomes prime minister. In 15, 20 years, you know, like it's going to be awesome. Also, I have a new Ben-Gvir theory I want to run by you.
Okay.
I don't think he is a particularly evil person or evil Jew even. Hear me out. He doesn't speak English. Like he did a couple words. He can kind of stumble in English because he's a Hebrew language speaker. He is simply just like the way he expresses himself is the way they talk in Hebrew. He is the dream and the hope of the Zionist project in like, you know, 1904 he is a totally like Hebrew speaking person. And he just, in the way the Hebrew language is just the way he is. He has completed the system of Zionist idealism. Like that's what it is. Like he's, you know what I'm saying? Like cannot express yourself in a rational, like English speaking way. You cannot be anything other than a genocidal maniac in Hebrew. So I'm saying like I don't, he's not a morally like, particularly odious person. He's just a person who only speaks Hebrew. This is just what they are.
Yeah. I mean, it's just what, yeah. It's like a Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in the flesh for Hebrew language. I'll allow it. Yeah.
Because all the other Hebrew speakers historically, generally have also spoken English, right? They were kind of LARPing as Hebrew speakers.
Well, Hebrew, in many ways. For those who may not be aware, is essentially a reconstructed language. Like there were no native Hebrew speakers when the standard Israel
was
found.
It was a in the era of like speaking classical Greek and Latin in school, if you were really smart, you also learned classical Hebrew. It was like the C tier of
the
classics.
And then you had rabbi, but it was not a spoken language even among the Jews. It was essentially
purely, Yiddish. Yeah.
I don't even know if it was a liturgical language. I know.
No, it was purely like research for classics. Like they had some copies of the Bible or the New Testament or the Old Testament. Sorry, because the New Testament was in Greek. There was some like biblical scholarship that had kept it, people who could speak it theoretically and, you know, could, but yes, it was not a,
well, and then
it was not a religious
thing. Like the Talmud, they had the Talmud and stuff, but that was, I don't think they had, I don't know. In any case, there was not a spoken language, like even by rabbis, even by, you know, like not by Jews, not by rabbis.
Yeah. I mean,
the
Jewish language was Yiddish. It's still kind of like, Yiddish kind of is arguably, dying in favor of Hebrew, but like, Yiddish was the Jewish language for a long time. And it's just like Yiddy German. It's not even like its own language. It's just like a German dialect, effectively.
Yeah.
Am I going too far with that? Is the Germans going to be offended? I'm going to get German hate. The Germans not going to like that? Yiddish is just a German dialect?
I know. But there's also Slavic. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, because the region, for the most part, was Russia and twist on it. Yeah. Yeah. Israel's in a tough spot. And they were talking about withdrawing. But I don't know. I mean, kind of just new normal as far as
Well, the question for me is that was this a pulled punch or was this like was this the actual best they can do, right? Because they've gone in with more troops than they did in 06, but the missions they're not going in as deep.
I mean, then they're already leaving Gaza. I mean, that's the other thing we haven't talked about Gaza, but they're leaving their ass hanging out in Gaza. I mean,
getting dabbed on by Hamas is still very much there, and like
So like. I don't think they have the manpower. I mean, certainly not with the active operations in Gaza. Not going to happen. And again, I think I've talked about it before, but their economy remains on the brink. They are in a very, very bad spot. They're like essentially redlining mobilization economy, the Heart of Iron UI. So like,
well, they're not quite though. There's still there's an available population they can't touch for reasons of Ben-Gvir. But
How many of those people are economically productive, though? Because, like, my thing, I mean, I get what you're saying, and of course, that's true for, like, the pure manpower side of it, but every Jew in a uniform is a Jew that's not making shekels in the real economy. That's the real, that's the problem.
Okay, let me hit you. How much of what is the real Israeli economy? Like, you know, like seriously, yeah, it's not even a meme. Like,
yeah,
it's not really a, they don't, they're not really producing finished goods or exporting food in like meaningful amounts. Like they have to call matzah farmers, yeah, like whatever. It's laundering money from like venture capitalist firms and the U.S. government. You know, it's a, like they're not, they're not going to run out of financial instruments. Like they're not, there's not going to be a shortage of, you know, what, some kind of esoteric credit swaps or like, you know, like, so what, some like venture capital investments in like some Israeli startups. Oh, the startup's not going to have a viable product in the next 2 years. Well, they weren't ever going to have a viable product anyway. So like, I question how much the Israeli economy can fall because how much, like, what much it, it was,
anyway. Yeah.
What, I don't think it's not producing anything. It was like, the matzah farms are still farming the matzah or whatever. The factories are still building like whatever, you know, 12 rockets a year they built, you know. The issue I think is that like they have had some import problems because like getting things through the Suez Canal has become slightly more challenging. But that's not like that. Like actually, that's arguably good for the economy that they're not quite as like, if your economic action is like goods being imported and paid for by U.S. tax dollars and sold to your citizens for consumption, that's not really like a, like if you lose that or like that gets interrupted, it's not like the death knell of your account. Like the Israeli GDP is fake. Like it's not, it's just, I think they can sustain this for a while. Actually, the thing is, it's the society, it's not so much the financial cost of the war, it's the, or even the material cost, it's the societal cost of basically becoming like a kind of a Sparta state where your 100,000 and really, so if you're 50, you have 50,000 guys who are like line infantry in brigades or combat brigades, and then you could probably flex that to 100,000 if you start pulling in pogues and cops and you know, your navy MP. Like you can probably plus that up to, if you have to, 100K of guys who can fight but aren't necessarily in combat brigades. But like if you got to keep those guys mobilized for 2 years to 5 years, like the societal costs of that are massive. You have to create your state as some kind of like Sparta, which is just like, it's just not, it's not actually a way to live. And people in the modern world can't sustain that. It's just, they just can't. Like, even if the losses aren't that bad, and of course, you know, very controversial how much, what the losses are, but just being in the field in combat, it will just, they're just going to fall apart. Desertion is already a problem. People are refusing to go back to Gaza. They're refusing to go to Lebanon. They're not reporting, and the Israeli army isn't cracking down on those guys. So that they're not calling them deserters, but like guys who just don't show up. They're not getting like arrested and stuff yet, right? Maybe that'll happen. But like when that starts, when enough guys. So the problem with this is, and this was even reported, is that so there was like some recon platoon was talking about this issue they had where they got demobilized for like a month of R&R, and they were going to go back to Gaza. And only six guys out of the 30 something in the platoon actually showed up. And they were basically leaked. They leaked this to the Times of Israel, or maybe it was Haaretz, that this happened to them because they were deployed into seven guys with the commander. So six guys and the commander were deployed into like platoon sized missions with a 7-man squad and like in Gaza. Cause like they were on paper, a platoon still. So like, and that was being leaked. Like, hey, we need to decide, are we going to prosecute people who don't show up, or are we going to stop sending guys to Gaza, or do we like just have to reorganize new platoons? Like there's some cracks showing in ways that are, I think, very frightening, and people are getting really, really sick of it. And especially because they have the same problem the Americans have, but on a much wider scale, with the population smaller, that there is like a limited warrior class to draw on. And the more you draw people out of that class into the, who aren't necessarily born or volunteer fighters, you get things like the engineering units in Gaza and Lebanon, who are just like the Israeli army is very sapper heavy, engineering unit heavy, because of how they operate. But if you look at the soldiers in these units, they're just guys who drive, you know, bulldozers. They're not like soldiers. And these infantry engineering units, just, I mean, a lot of the highlight videos from Hezbollah and Hamas are these engineering units just getting dabbed on because they're not frontliners. They're support units. And yes, they're like a frontline support unit. Like combat engineers in the American army are considered combat arms, whatever. But like moving yellow machines and doing like infantry drilling and infantry like battle drills is just a totally different like mindset. It creates a different kind of person. I've never been of the opinion that like Jews are just like inherently terrible soldiers, but there is this phenomenon in military history, even in like European countries where there were more quote unquote like born fighters, is that if you are, this actually been a lot of World War II, if you are an infantry unit and you are trained to be an infantry unit from like since you joined up, the performance and morale and all these metrics is almost universally better than if you are a non-infantry person, you didn't sign up for infantry, or even a conscript who starts in an infantry unit. If you don't have that identity as an infantry man and like that background and assumptions you make that like shape you psychologically, you have a worse time if you're forced into an infantry role. The U.S. Army had this problem in World War II because they had to like project like 18 months out what your losses would be, and they would chronically underproject infantry losses and overproject everyone else's losses. So they assumed that after like the Battle of Britain and like the bombing campaigns in like back and forth between the islands and Germany, they would need all these AA gunners. They would need tons of anti-aircraft gunners because they took so many losses in the Battle of Britain and they saw the Germans taking losses in the same way in when they were arriving Germany. So, okay, we'll need more AA gunners. Turns out infantrymen in World War II in France get killed at orders of magnitude higher than they expected. And AA gunners literally never died ever. Because like the Germans weren't flying into like they weren't flying
Seed 1943 vintage Seed. Yes.
Yeah, it just wasn't happening, bro. So what they did was they created a division, I believe it's a division out of these AA gunners and retrained them into be infantrymen, and they put them through in France the equivalent of infantry basic training. Like they basically re-basic training them all the way to baseline to become infantrymen. And so they had the same amount of training as a infantry unit. But they just chronically underperformed because they didn't want to fucking be infantrymen because that's not what they signed up to be or were drafted into being. And you have this problem, I think, when you start creating Erstat's infantry units in the surge, we have this problem too. Like cooks and MPs that you forced to be on convoy duty will get like they just didn't sign up for that shit. Or even were if they weren't, I was drafted and trained to something else. Like I'm not fundamentally infantryman, and that's going to, I think, cause issues for the IDF as they are forced to either like create Erstat's infantry units in some ways. And I think they're gonna take pretty heavy losses, especially as, you know, it's if you're a reservist cook or a reservist MP or a reservist like admin guy and you get called up, and not only are you called up, you're sent to infantry school to be an infantryman, like you're gonna be fucking pissed. You didn't sign up for that shit. Like you're not gonna enjoy it. You know, you're gonna be a worse infantryman. I think that's what you see with these engineer units, who are kind of like the first of these units that are being used very aggressively in Gaza, very aggressively in Lebanon, like in some ways in front of the infantry who are theoretically in the tankers who are theoretically like the combat forces, and they're just getting dabbed on because they don't have the inbuilt paranoia of infantry training where like at any moment something will like, oh, they're like part of the infantry training is always like, oh, you're just doing infantry tasks in the woods, and like, oh, now you're being hit with artillery. Like they just like you're constantly, oh, now you have to run, like you're being artillery, you have to run like a kilometer and get behind some shit. Like they throw RD sims at you. It's a lot of fun. Not really. It actually sucks because you got to carry all your gear. But like they inbreed this paranoia in infantry soldiers in training of like you're gonna be hit with mortars or artillery or something constantly. So you're always like a little bit paranoid, and you keep that paranoia when you deploy to Iraq or whatever. But like that paranoia is good, and you can clearly see some of these units that are getting hit by Hamas are like totally relaxed and just chilling in a way that you see like non-infantry soldiers chill sometimes, where like nigga, you are in Gaza. You do not get to like hang out, you know, and you just see guys like sitting down and joking around, and there's just none of the paranoia. And that's reservist. Yeah, it's undisciplined. Like any soldier will do that if they're just not supervised, but you just don't see them like they're just not expecting to get hit. And I think that's when you get really, really, really fucked up. And like, I think more and more of these Hamas videos coming out of you see like guys firing at a tank, like, and then like the tank takes a hit and just stops. And like, not all of maybe they killed the whole crew or wounded the whole crew. But like, I think you are seeing people who shouldn't be in certain places like driving tanks because they're like the reservist women, whatever. They just get hit and shut down because they don't necessarily dismount. I don't think they're all dead in the tank. It's just an RPG. Tandem head or not, I don't think they don't really like get crew kills all that much. It's just a lower quality of troopers who just aren't used to it, who just want to, okay, fuck, if we play dead in our tank, you know, the QRF will get here before they, you know, they run, like the way they're fighting in Gaza after the invasion of Lebanon is just it's such a fall off. It's like BioWare, bro. They just fell off. They can't, they're just not as good as they once were. Fuck. I don't know. I'm rambling, but like, whew, like it's, they're in a really bad spot where they say they'll start making decisions. I think they're going to have to start, like, Also, you get into weird shit, though, because, like, Ben-Gvir is, like, the Minister of the Interior. They're not going to let the Ministry of the Interior, which is, like, the police. If the Ministry of the Interior starts rounding up, like, secular Zionists who aren't serving up their time, so they have to go to the front, and Ben-Gvir and his friends don't, that's bad optics. The IDF, who would, okay, that's one option that can't round these people up, because that would look terrible. Okay, so, well, there's, like, the, what if the IDF has its own, like, MPs on this duty? Well, those MPs are the ones who are also, like, shirking and not showing up, too. Like, who's going to, if you are going to have, like, them round up, not quite deserters, so just, like, guys who just didn't, like, AWOLs, basically. Who's going to do that? You know? Like, especially if you need these MPs to be doing, like, your military, like, you have these massive prisons full of fighters, or fighter Hamas fighters, or suspected Hamas fighters, or just civilians. Like, do you, like, those guys are already kind of tasked out on this massive, like POW, quote-unquote POW apparatus. So, like, who would even enforce a kind of a desertion prosecution regime? They're in a real tight, tight spot. And I think the best option is, I think, the peace deal of they pull out of Lebanon, and they pull out of Gaza, and the Gazans release the hostages, and Israel pulls out of Gaza, and they release their hostages. And I like, that's the only good option here. Like, I don't think you just can't bomb Lebanon into whatever. Is Iran's going to strike them again? I hope to God on right before the election, because I think it'd be funny to do it Monday night before the election, but they don't operate that way. The one thing is that Shia groups historically don't do the anniversary attack bit. That's actually like a Sunni thing. So people say, oh, it's the anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. It's the anniversary of whatever. It's the holiday, whatever. The Shia don't really play that game with their attacks. They just kind of do it whenever. They don't consider the anniversaries to be that big a deal. It's very much like 9/11 attacks on 9/11 are like a Sunni type thing. And the Iranians just don't, they just don't go for the anniversary bit. So yeah, that's that. Do you want to transition to Ukraine, or what are we looking at time-wise?
Yeah, we can do a little Ukraine. It's funny because it's on the one hand, stuff is happening on the other. I think, in a way, even though there's a lot more like shit town for farmhouses at a crossroads on a map being taken, the general dynamic is pretty stable, which is collapse, crumbling, but getting pushed back pretty consistently, but not yet in a threatening way. I'm curious. I think the next few months will be very. I think basically it's going to either our buddy is right and it's going to be Q1 2025, or it's going to drag out for several more years. I don't really think there's any in between. I've been saying for a while, I think the overall Russian grand strategy is for a push to Pavlograd. I think everything pretty neatly, like it's Pokrovsk is the first big objective on route to Pavlograd. There are lots of moves in that direction, but there's also such a dire situation across the board that it at a certain level it gets hard to see how, like, morale and the internal political factors don't become dispositive more so than more quote-unquote purely military or operational.
Oh god, I'm sorry, I forgot one major thing about the IDF, which is, like, you guys are going to like this if you're IDF haters, which most of our audience I feel like are.
I would hope.
Yes. So the IDF, big, like, generally, obviously, they've often tried to adopt their own rifles, their own artillery pieces, their own, but they always end up, like, defaulting to, like, actually the US just gives us better, more numerous, cheaper gear than we could make ourselves, and it kind of historically guts their, like, internal military-industrial complex, with the one exception of the Merkava, which is a modernization, effectively, or a, you know, generational upgrade of this British Centurion tank, which was which was the old British tank for the Challenger that they liked more. It's a very good tank, I think. I mean, but it's a modern tank and has the problems of all the problem tanks have, you know, just what it is. But they, because of their egos at like wanting to have their own tank, they can't just get new ones from America, right? They have to make them themselves. Hezbollah claims that they've disabled or like damaged, or like they've fucked up about 40 Merkavas in the last in the month of October. We know the total fleet number of Merkava 4s and 3s was about 750, and then like 300 more scheduled to be delivered in the next few years. So when we got those numbers, it was a couple of years ago. So maybe they have 800 tanks. If Hezbollah took out, let's say, 40.
5 to 10% of their fleet. Yeah, just like that.
And that's not counting Gaza and the guy and the JDAMs being Una reverse carded onto fucking Merkavas there. So we talk about like legitimate percentage points of their tank fleet just gone and not replaceable by, like, theoretically, yes, the Americans could send them Abrams, right? But like, wow, that's a, yeah. And the thing is, they don't have problems with the bulldozers because they're just Caterpillars. They're not anything fancy. They're just like, you know, they weld some armor plates on I think, I forget what model of Caterpillar. Like, they can just get those from America infinitely. But like the Merkavas, because they've made this like their prestige internal thing, no, it's just not happening. You know, like it's over. If they keep this war going, there's a chance they literally run out of tanks, especially if they keep trying to invade Lebanon, where like they're just getting absolutely dabbed on by really, really good Russian and Iranian ATGMs, which didn't really get to shine in Ukraine as much. But the ATGM in the Lebanon war is really showing its value, I think, because it's just the hilliness, the open sight lanes, not a lot of tree lines, obviously, in the scrubland, or what do you want to call like the hilly border areas. So I think there's a very good chance that like the material losses are impact. Like at some point they have to look at like, oh, we've lost 10% of our tanks. Like that's
it's huge. Yeah. I mean that, yeah. You know, cause it's not just the tanks obviously that you have in service. It's the ones you have in storage. It's their parts. It's ones,
and also the tank, I mean, yes, true, tanks, if they're, most of them are recovered and like you can repair tanks are actually very repairable. It's just how much time you want to put into building. You know, you got to cut out the damaged armor pieces, put new pieces in, et cetera, et cetera. Some are not obviously salvageable, but like that's all time you're not using to build new tanks, right? Because you can basically get a truly like rusted out and like really fucked up T-72 from like the desert in Kuwait that was blown up in 1991 and get to the factory in Russia. And they can like use that chassis to create a new tank,
yeah,
theoretically. But like that's time you're not spending on making new tanks, right? So, you know.
Why not?
Yeah.
What? No, we keep saying is Israel. Yeah. It's almost harder to see. I guess I don't know. Ukraine, ironically, maybe has some advantages. Israel doesn't in terms of there's, I think, theoretically a path forward in principle where like Ukraine as look, you have a chair at the UN. You're a real country and everything.
Like you and the Khmer Rouge. Yeah. Like the exile thing. Like,
yeah, no,
the Khmer Rouge no longer have their seat. But that was the U.S. trying to point out the U.S. kept the Khmer Rouge like in power in exile because they were sad that the North Vietnamese like destroyed their like little genocide empire that was like U.S. backed. It's very funny.
But I don't even mean like a government in exile. I mean, yeah, literally you could have like a parliament in Kyiv and everything. You know, you could do the whole bit. It's not a foregone conclusion, I don't think, that all that stops existing. I do think that's where we're heading is the destruction of quote unquote Ukraine as a geopolitical entity, except for some kind of, yeah, like the MEC isn't the government in exile, is it, in the, for Iran? That's something
they claim to be.
Okay, all right,
they have two governments. Whatever, yeah. So there were two Geops. So there is there is the crown prince who has, in violation of so traditionally in most, I actually don't know this specifically for the Persian or Iranian monarchy, traditionally the reason he was called the crown prince, the Shahoid, he's now declared himself like king and been crowned. But traditionally, to be crowned king of a place, you need to be in the place. Like in Britain, yeah, you have to.
I mean,
when the queen dies, you become the crown prince until you sit on the Destiny Stone and have the coronation. Yeah. Presumably, usually to be crowned, you have to be in the actual place to be crowned. He was crowned in, like, I'm sure, some shitty hotel ballroom in North Virginia. But now the crown prince is now declared himself the Shah. He is the government in exile. And then the MEC have their own government in exile in, I believe, Greece. Both like totally like the MEC is actually CIA backed and Mossad backed, and I think the MEC and the Shahoids are just like John Bolton's like friends. You know, I don't think they get a certain amount of money for being who they are, but not actually like sponsorship. Yeah. They're a total joke, dude. Shahoids, I actually don't give a shit. Like, I will see. I'm on Lebanese Twitter a good bit somehow, of course, because the algorithm will give me that because it thinks I'm like pro Hezbollah, which is true. And like they'll like sometimes they'll just say, "Oh, look at this shit dirtbag, the Shah," and I respond to him a couple times like, dude, no one cares what the Shah thinks. Like, he can say whatever he wants. And they were like, yeah, you know, like, they get indignant about, like, the Shah making pronunciations about, like, Lebanon or Iran. I'm like, Yeah, yeah, but like he's a joke. Like giving him attention is like gives him like whatever little bit of power. Like he's got a least Rolls Royce. I don't think he's like a threat to Iran. You know, like don't worry. Yeah, like he's not. Yeah,
there's not. Yeah, he's not doing anything.
Yeah, like he's a mildly. He's not even like a businessman. Like what is this shit? Like
oh, he's just a piece of shit. He's just a rich asshole.
Okay, I'm gonna say it. Trust one. Post NJP, Mike Enoch is still more powerful than the Shah of Iran.
Yeah, he's true. Undoubtedly. I mean, yeah.
Like we were ranking like the power rankings of like influence and power in the current world. Mike Enoch is like several steps above the Shah of Iran.
Honestly, you and I probably would also be just like an objective.
Yeah, the Shah doesn't even have a podcast. He doesn't have a podcast.
Just saying. So yeah, no, I mean, yeah, what a joke. But what were we talking? Oh yeah, no. So yeah, with the Ukraine, I mean, just to like, I don't know how much even there is additional to say. Like the line keeps getting pushed back. I do think we're on track for. I wonder. I guess the first like it seems. I think what we're gonna see happen first is Ukrainian elements in Kursk wiped out and full control established over. Over Donetsk and Lugansk oblasts. Then I guess there's now Kherson is constitutionally part of the Russian Federation. Is that do I have that right? And Zaporozhye is the third. I
believe yes, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Lugansk, Lugansk. Yeah. Kharkiv is not, which is interesting.
No, currently, which is yeah. So that's a kind of like that's a big asterisk. That's why I'm talking about like sequencing of events. It's noteworthy that Lugansk is basically already taken, and they're mopping up. That's I guess the story currently is they're mopping up Donetsk and basically there's a kind of every so often there are rumblings of something happening in Zaporozhye and then nothing ever happens. That was you know famously the big failed Ukrainian counteroffensive 2023, like the worst telegraphed, worst I mean just complete it's again kind of hard to understand people's thought processes unless you're like oh your brain is frozen in like 1993 or something so yeah the but in any case there's the essentially what Russia has done is erase the Ukrainian gains during that failed counteroffensive but not really move the football past there and then Kherson following the withdrawal I guess there was like a brief minute where they were like fucking around on the other side of the river, but immediately kind of it wasn't actually establishing a bridgehead because that's kind of impossible in the current circumstances. So yeah, I think we're going to be looking at a situation possibly as early as quarter 1/25 of Russia being in full control of its own, like no more Kursk salient and no more and full control over Donetsk and Lugansk, which in principle, in theory. You could
call that a pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, like or you know, it wouldn't. I would hate it, but you could see the conditions for a ceasefire at least, and you know, freezing of the conflict along those lines. I don't actually think that's realistic. I don't think that's what's going to happen. And I think the war will continue to drag on for years. But I also think again, I mean, the situation is so dire, and you have. Highly ideologically motivated, highly armed, the best trained and most experienced units. It's like the Praetorian Guard around Zelensky in Kyiv. Like at what point do the meatheads be like, you know what? You've fucked this up. You've had your moment. Like we're tired of getting our shit pushed in Donbass. I don't think that's going to improve their strategic situation, but it does get me wondering if you're a Ukrainian grunt, sitting on a hole getting JDAM, what's going through your mind? Why do you continue to hold that rifle? I never really got it, but now it's and it seems like there's a lot of people who are asking this question. Please, yeah, well, I want to hear what you have to say.
I mean, a lot of it is that like European states just are like strong states. Like even the weakest European state, is it more of an actual state than the strongest Arab state? I include Israel in that. Like
yeah.
Like, you know, like states like European states don't really collapse. You know, like the USSR didn't collapse. It like
neither did Germany.
Kind of just like, kind of peacefully like deconstructed. You know, like they just like okay, well, like the state apparatus of the USSR basically surrendered and okay, we'll split off some provinces and but like the state kind of remained the state, you know. Yeah, East and West Germany split apart and came back together pretty smooth. You know, like these states surrendered, the apparatus was maintained. Like, states are just power, very powerful things. That's why you need to have control of them, right? If you want to do anything. I think that's one of the things I think is chronically underestimated by the Ukrainians, and is that they are a European military with a large population. Like, they're not, they're like the states, every state has significant war making capacity. So it's effect. I question how much attrition has even affected that, you know, like the,
Well, that's the story. No, I agree. Well, that's the story of the last few weeks, is that we're just now starting to see the actual, like, attrition actually starting to matter a little bit in a real way versus, like, yeah, up to this point, it basically.
Yeah. But, like, so for instance, like the Ukrainians have no centralized military industrial complex really anymore. Like, they're not creating new stuff. Most, it's all heavily imports, and they go to things, get to, like fixing tanks happens in Poland. There are obviously, like, mechanic shops and stuff, like frontline mechanic stuff and depots, but they're a European state, much like the Germans. They have created a distributed military industrial complex where they are producing these one-way drones in very significant numbers. Like, the Ukrainian drone production seems comparable even to the Russians, you know? The Russian is a little nicer. The Russian stuff is a little nicer. It's got fewer weld marks. It's, like, you know, a little cleaner looking, but, like, capability-wise, the Ukrainian drones seem as good or better than the Russian ones. You know, it's kind of a wash. Like, it's an FPV drone, bro. It's gonna fucking kill you. Like, it's not I don't think, and I hope to God one of these, you know, Arab or Muslim countries can pull it off. But, like, if Hezbollah ever got to the point where they were creating, like, the distributed industry, like, one-way FPV drones, it would be so comically over for Israel. Like, you know, like, currently Iran makes most of them, and I'm sure they'll make some of them, but, like, if they could achieve, even at, like, you know, just for per capita, the amount of in-house distributed industry one-way drone production, like, effectively, like, you know, in small tool shops, like, the state of Israel would no longer exist. It would just be
FPV swarms over Tel
Aviv. Yeah, it'd be so over. Like, you know, and like Ukrainians,
a biblical plague. Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, that would be fun.
The Europeans have a very strong state, and as a matter of course, you know. And I just don't. That's why I don't see Ukraine collapsing even.
No, like, I don't think they're going to collapse either. I think we're in for a long war. I think we're in for a drive across the Dnieper the hard way, and probably a siege of Kharkov, and then we'll see where the kind of,
yeah. Trump has no fucking idea, bro. Like, the Trump promise of, I'm going to end the war in Ukraine in the first 100 days, yeah. Bro. No.
He just thinks he's going to, like, make a scary look at Putin, and Putin's going to be scared. And,
well, he thinks so. Listening to Trump, he's lying somewhat, but he's talking like, I listened to the Joe Rogan interview, and he's saying, like, he basically said he threatened to nuke Beijing and Moscow in, like, private conversations with both Xi Jinping and Putin. And, like, I'm sure they kind of, like, if that even happened, they kind of just, like, laughed it off, like, haha, okay, yeah. You know, like whatever, you fucking crazy person. If Putin made, like, if Trump made that threat, like, oh, if you don't make peace with Ukraine on our terms, I'm going to nuke Moscow, Putin would just call the bluff. Like, no, you're not. Yes. Like, fuck out of here. Like, we're trying to do a thing here. Like, you know.
Well, that's what goes back to what I was saying before, right, about, like, the post-Westphalia and post-World War II order just kind of, yeah, I mean, it's laughable. But I also want to say, and I kind of always figured this, but I don't know how much of it was just being ignorant and how much of it was video game brain. Ordering a nuclear strike and that kind of, we would talk about just, you know, while we're talking about things that are imaginary, never going to happen. The thing is, like, you can't just, like, in a video game, if it's a civilization, you can have, like, a nuclear missile. You can send your one nuclear missile onto the enemy capital, and maybe it even destroys it. And maybe that even, you know, proves pivotal in your, like, maybe you launch it at just the right moment in terms of a thing. But in addition to the fact that you would never just, do that, even in a game of civilization, you know, in other words, send one nuclear missile at your enemy capital, that's just not how any of this works at a technical level. Any such strike would have to, I mean, it obviously wouldn't be the end of a process, not at the beginning of one, but even in terms of the end of that process, or, like, assuming, you know, pretending for the sake of argument that we could have such a one-off, you would need to send a lot of missiles and a lot of, it wouldn't just be one thing. And there's no guarantee that if it were all of those things, that those things wouldn't all be shot down. I think it was very impressive. The two generations old Russian air defense systems, as far as I could tell, basically didn't let anything meaningful through on Iran's side. We can only imagine what S-500s could do. But certainly one solitary, missile or airstrike or whatever like that is just never, ever. Like, that's not going to get within 1,000 kilometers of Moscow, period. So obviously Trump is bloviating, and he may, I wouldn't assume that he didn't, like, that he, like, he may actually be dumb enough to think that that he could, as president, send a nuclear missile at Moscow as, like, a threat. I don't know. I'm not inside his head. I'm not. I genuinely have no idea. It's more like, yeah, in terms of the way the game is played and the way things actually work, what's Trump going to do? Like, that's my question. I don't know what Trump is going to do. I don't know what's going to be different. I don't know that anything is. Like, forget about all, like, the internal domestic stuff and new stuff and all of that. Do you think that it's going to make any? I think there is an argument that it would make a difference in terms of Israel. I think for purely internal domestic American political reasons, President Harris is going to have a harder time funding Israel's genocide. Like, President Trump is going to give him a blank check.
Hear me out, brother. I think Trump has a harder time because it's the kind of Nixon and China bit, right? Where if Trump is going hard for Israel, the entire left, if you hear about these people, the left, they have, like, even the Harris people have permission to go fully anti-Trump. Trump is a racist. Trump hates Arabs. Like, and they're going to go, especially if he loses, as, like, say Trump wins Michigan too, right? Like, maybe it happens. The Democratic Party will become like, oh, fuck, we, like, alienated the pro-Palestinian people. And, like, they would somewhat realign, and they would go very hard. Whereas if Harris wins, you get this thing where the Republicans are all for total genocide of Palestinians. The Democrats in the party establishment are also for total genocide of Palestinians. If Trump wins, the party Democrats will stop being, like, so vociferously pro-genocide of all Palestinians, and they'll create, like, actual party opposition, like spending bills being blocked, maybe, like, all kind of stuff could happen.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but I have a hard time. Like, you think Chuck Schumer is going to let that happen? I have my doubts.
Well, it depends how many, like, it depends how many people, like, Chuck Schumer is probably, like, I don't view him as a bloodthirsty. I see him as, like, like, the optics users already kind of want a ceasefire, you know? Like,
oh, he's in the blinking camp for sure. Yeah, no, yeah. He's, I mean, yeah.
So,
yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. So they're like, oh, guys, could you cut it out? Like, this looks really bad. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas if Harris, okay. when Harris is king of America, like, it's just going to be like unlimited genocide of Palestinians forever and ever on both sides, right? So I do think Trump winning gives the Democrats permission to be anti-war, and they love doing that bit. And they'll do it for shitty reasons.
They haven't gotten to do it in a while. That's the kind of, like, I mean, not to debase ourselves by doing normie political content, but I mean, it is kind of funny to me, as someone who, yeah, cut his teeth on opposition to the Iraq war, and that's, like, how I really learned to be anti-Semitic and just hating Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and all those people. The kind of back and forth over Liz Cheney. Like, so there's a yeah, which, by the way, like, who the fuck is Liz Cheney? Like, I mean, old friend on Twitter said something like, what happened to Dick Cheney? I don't get it. It's like, oh, he had a heart transplant and then became a tranny. And didn't you hear, like, he was a big heart operation because he was really old and he needed a new heart. And but then after his surgery, he discovered he was actually a woman inside, and that's how he renamed himself to Liz Cheney. In any case, yeah, it's funny to watch this. It's just not even, I mean, that's the part I think that there's like a certain kind of libtard that just, like, their head is exploding because they grew up with Jon Stewart and the Mesopotamia bit and all of that, like, all of that shit. And now they're being not even requested or demanded, just sort of implicitly assumed, like, oh, yes, remember our old friend Dick Cheney, who we love so much because, like, you know, they're America and stuff. Vote for Harris. Like, there has to be people whose heads are just exploding. They're not, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe people are just so partisan or they just hate orange faggot that, that much that they just kind of, you know, they do, you know, it turns into to light switch brain. But I just cannot imagine being a libtard and to their credit, there does seem to be a significant faction of the Democrat Party that they're like, why are we talking about the Cheneys? Like, why is this why is this a topic of
conversation? Yeah, that's why. Have you heard like Kamala is throwing argument that Kamala might be throwing?
I've seen. Dude,
if I was running for like mayor of like, I don't know, like any shitty rural town, right? And Liz Cheney was like, I endorse you, I would be like, I would immediately disavow,
right?
She'd call me on the phone, like, hey, I want to endorse you, Lewis. I like your campaign. Like, oh, is this Liz Cheney? Of like the Iraq War Cheneys? Like,
yeah, right.
So are you fucking, no. And they parade that shit. Like, I feel like,
yeah,
you're throwing.
It's like, yeah, no, well, you got, I mean, I don't, what I think it is a particularly craven, tone deaf, and yes, like 80s, 90s frozen brain syndrome.
Yes, the idea is if you run like more to the center, you'll win the election, which is like very, very 90s.
That's what I'm saying. That's like 1988 brain. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly,
I'll take the center. And it's like, I don't know, bro. Like, is Liz Cheney a centrist? Like,
I mean, she's, you know, she was too liberal for her Wyoming seat that she won because of her dad. And I forget how she ended up in Wyoming.
The Chase are from there.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Not Texas, right. You would think, right? Yeah. So, they're very funny. There's an amendment, the president, and it's like, actually, no, I don't think it's an amendment. It's like, no, I don't know if it's an amendment. It's one of the early, like very early ones, post Bill of Rights, or it's in the Constitution itself, where the president and the vice president can't be from the same state. And Cheney was from Wyoming, but he had lived after becoming CEO of Halliburton. He moved to Texas, right? So W and Cheney were both from Texas, which is actually illegal. So like the month prior to the election, Cheney like got a license, like a driver's license with his wife's like parents' house in somewhere in Colorado. Or no, sorry, Wyoming, like somewhere. So he officially is a they're a Wyoming political family. The Texas stuff was like purely Dick, like the family is from. And he was the senator. He was also the senator from Wyoming.
Okay, I only knew him as like the oil guy. I didn't realize it. Not that it.
Yeah, he was in the he was a congressional staffer. Oh, if you watch the movie Vice with Christian Bale, it's very good. Okay. I just recommend watching it. You get a pretty good Cheney biography.
Is that the one? Has the bit where he shoots the dude in the face?
It's actually it's there, but it's very brief. Actually, it's not actually. It's in there. Yeah, but like. It's a really good comedy. Steve Carell plays Donald Rumsfeld. It's very funny.
Okay, yeah, no, that sounds. Yeah, but okay. So Steve Carell, Daily Show veteran. I mean, that's the thing. He would have literally. That's a bit that they would have done in like 2005, right? 2007, 2009. Like it would have started getting a little old, but even then, well into the Obama years, they were still milking that cow. So that would have been. That would have been because the Daily Show, I mean, it left a huge cultural impact on a certain segment of the population. The numbers were not huge. Yeah, well, right.
like, you know where we are. This is a show on TRS, you know, like a flagship show called The Daily Show. Yeah, like a bit of a cultural impact there, guy.
Right, exactly. So like,
you know what I do people, miss? I guess, remember the era when TRS shows all had to be like a joke on a news program? Yeah. That was a good era. We kind of, I feel like we kind of broke that mold a little bit, but you know, whatever.
Well, whatever. No, well, we're historical, you know, for nationalists and it's hand in hand doing our part. I don't know. Do you want to make a prediction? I predicted this for the the election.
I have grabbed like not on the show. Oh, it's been referenced the old times. I have grabbed like three different hot stoves in PolitiFact betting things that I thought were undervalued. So I'm not doing it again. That said, Elon Musk is doing this weird thing where he's manipulating the poly market, the prediction pools. So if you think Harris, buy your bets on poly market. She's deeply undervalued, right? Like really undervalued, like 33%. So basically, the odds are a coin flip, right? If I were you, I would buy undervalued Harris coin there, if you want to buy Trump, do it through Predictit, where you're not getting, you don't have to pay this premium because Musk isn't manipulating that market. Dude, it's such a coin flip. I think it all comes down to Pennsylvania. I think Trump is weaker in Pennsylvania than he thinks. Or no, actually, no, I think he knows he's weak in Pennsylvania, which is why they're doing like an absolute, like constant rallies, the giving away money to register to vote stuff, like just giving like $200 to register to vote is crazy. I think it's all Pennsylvania, really. Maybe Michigan is in the mix. It seems like North Carolina is going to break for Trump. Everyone's kind of like got a soft consensus on that. I don't know. I think Trump has it, but
it does feel a lot like this, you know, how's Donnie going to get out of it this time? You know, there's no way. And then
like,
yeah, once
there's
again,
no bad, I can celebrate every single permutation here and I can gloat. Like,
yes,
if Donald Trump wins, nope. I'm happy. If Kamala wins, I'm it's like, okay, great. Like, cause the Kamala wins, we get to go back to like you guys, like weirdos on Twitter, not hating on us. I also can't wait to get blamed for her victory. Because then I can just say, well, why didn't he appeal to me?
Fun. Yeah, right. No, why didn't you do something? Well, she's giving me expanded child tax credits. What are you giving me?
Yeah.
Or whatever. You know, like, yeah.
Oh, we endlessly ban them, yeah. And then right. If Trump wins, I get to bully those guys, and then they'll slowly come on my side.
When they inevitably have, I mean, that's I think I agree with you. I don't, it just feels like Trump is going to win. My prediction is for
Kansas. We're also Twitter brain.
Extended. Yeah.
No, I think I actually think that's one thing I will say. They might say stolen election, Kamala stole it, but they grabbed that hot after January 6th. They're not going to say there might like be a couple very.
I'm not. No. I don't mean that. I mean, well, maybe, but I mean more. What I'm saying is, I expect a drawn out process. I don't expect a call for at least several days, maybe a week, maybe two.
I think there'll be a call within a day. It's going to be like the next morning, at least, for sure.
Nah. I mean, not unless there's like a total blowout, but even then, I don't think they have been signaling hard. Now, again, maybe it's a fake out or maybe it doesn't materialize, but the libtards have been signaling. They've been doing the bit of like, don't you know that it's always taken weeks and weeks to get a finalized count? And, you know, the election night calls were just indicative. There weren't actually anything. And with all the, you know, blah, 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 they're just making excuses. No, they're definitely seeding a drawn out process and yeah, again, not that that'll materialize. I think Trump could win that process. I don't think it's foregone conclusion that if there is such a process that automatically means Trump is going to lose. I just expect chaos and a drawn out whatever. And yeah, as far as the outcome, to me it comes down to like, because I'm going to be honest, I don't have the visceral hatred of Trump that a lot of, I know like Mike and Jesse and those guys really viscerally hate Trump to the point where they actively want him to lose. I get it. And I mean, it's not that I like want him to win. I just frankly don't care enough about him. What were you going to say?
I wouldn't say Mike actually, me and Mike have the same problem where we like, you listen to Trump speak and like, you kind of like, oh, he is like individually charming. Mike doesn't truly hate Trump. And I don't think he would say he truly, in the way Sven is, yeah, dude.
The contempt.
I love it. I wish I could hate Trump that much, you know?
I, to me, it's like, okay, do you want the libtards to cry, or do you want the rightoids to cry? Like, who?
Well, on a long enough timeline, rightoids are always crying, right? So
yes,
you know,
it's not that I want Trump to win or that I have anything. I just think it would be like the butt hurt. The butt hurt would be so epic. Whereas, like, the butt hurt from the rightoids, especially if they start whining about election fraud, that would be very tasty as well. I'm not going to lie. That would be very tasty as well. However, I think, like, libtard tears are, like, succulent in a way. No, I don't know. I don't know how to put it. But ultimately, I think it would be funnier if Trump won. I think it would be, like, the butt hurt reaction would be funnier. And the other thing is, while the cult will always be there, I do think there's a segment of like insufficiently disciplined our guys who are like, I don't know, for whatever reason have some kind of faith that Trump is going to do something, or I don't know what.
There's a word for that. It's called not being a dissident.
Yeah, right.
You're not
voters.
Bro.
They're the vote. You know, like the Coomers, the voter, and
Jerry Wigg voter.
And these people, there's some of them, not going to name names, but you know who you are. We're just going to need to learn the lesson the hard way. And
okay, you know what? Our friend in New York, who I'll tell you who it is after. I think you know what we're talking about, but he described himself as being like, he said initially he felt like Cassandra from the Iliad. You know, like
this
horse is full of Greeks, right? But he realized he's not doing like prophecy. It's like, imagine if the horse was full of Greeks, but the Trojans like won the battle anyway, like after they got fooled, and then they sent a second like shittily made horse, like this horse is clearly like it's like paper mache.
Like transparent though. It's like literally it doesn't even have the wood covering. It's like just they're out in the open. Like, look, there's Greeks in that thing that kind of vaguely looks like a horse.
Yeah, it's like not like it's like there's like they ran out. Like, it's like made of linen. Like you can see like Greeks inside, like in the outline of Greek soldiers and armor. And he's like, ah, remember the previous horse? I believe this horse is now full of Greeks. And everyone's like, no, you just take the W. They're clearly giving us a second victory horse because we beat them so bad in the last race. and it's
very much that kind of energy. Yes,
stop 100%. Longhousing me, Cassandra. Cassandra is trying to longhouse you by telling you the horse is full of Greeks.
The longhouse post. Yeah, that's the thing. Could you imagine the longhouse posting if Kamala's president? Like, oh my god, it's just gonna be insufferable.
Like, that's how I feel. Is like it's like you can look at all these major Jews. I agree with him. I feel like the way he feels that it's like, oh yeah, no, like it's just like hopeless. Like at a certain point, you have to make like Aeneas and just like, I'm not part of that thing anymore, dude. Like, I guess
not doing it. We're not. Yeah, doing
it. We're gonna go somewhere else. We're gonna do a new thing. Kind of a, you know, we're gonna refound a new Troy without these fucking retards somewhere. You know.
Yeah. I don't know. I will say that the quants, the Nate Silvers are complaining. They think that the neck and neckness is overrated. They like they're hurting. Nobody wants to be the outlier. Everybody's clustering. Yeah.
Oh, RCP, no toss up does break for Trump. So,
yeah, and Pennsylvania is likely to be the
I believe under RCP no toss up though they have Michigan going Democrat, right?
Well, that was like the most recent. That was the big all the Trumpoids were crying because whereas Trump had been up in pretty much all the battlegrounds, the most recent and the last before the election polls. In particular, Michigan were like +3.
Harris. Yeah. So according to RCP no toss up, it's literally comes down to there's RCP no toss throws Michigan going to Harris Walz, but Pennsylvania is like the decider because like so there if Pennsylvania goes Harris Walz, it would, which it doesn't in this map, but it would bring them exact 270 on the fucking dot because it's 19 electoral votes. But if Michigan breaks Trump and Pennsylvania breaks for Harris, it's still a Trump victory. So.
Yeah, he has more pathways. I think that's
but great. I don't know, does he though? Because like Arizona can always break funny.
We'll see. Lose. I mean, again, it's a kind of funny, like not that invested in the outcome, but I do find the whole thing is weird, and it's been a weird. I mean, Biden is still technically president. Everybody seems to. I don't know. It's just funny how what a shit show American politics are. And only
I will say also in RCP no toss shows a slight popular vote edge for Trump, which is crazy.
There are and people have been talking about this for a while on Twitter. There are quite a few. There's like a more substantial than you might otherwise think possibility of Trump winning the popular vote but losing the electoral vote. Which
and I will laugh and laugh. Actually, I
talk
have
about
my new
funny outcome. Yeah,
I have my new funny outcome. Yeah, actually, no, we're doing that. Let's do that. That's the one thing that would get me to motivate me to vote for Trump was to hope for that, but I couldn't take the stain of voting for a genocide.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oh, that would be funny.
That would objectively be the funniest outcome.
Oh, who are you comically writing in this year?
Adolf Hitler, as always. Yeah.
Really? So I was thinking,
it's tried and true.
Initially, my first thought was Yahya Sinwar, right? Clearly topical.
Oh, that's
right?
That's a good
one. In honor of the man. But I was thinking of doing like somebody who I would actually like if they found out I wrote them in, they would get mad.
That's another good approach. Yes. Okay.
Like writing in Marion Williamson, because like she'd be pissed if I wrote
like
her
someone,
in.
Someone in like, yeah, okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like somebody who would be angry that I wrote them in instead of like their person. You know, like RFK, obviously. He's on the ballot, though. That's not right. Well, I was thinking, RFK is not really a write-in because, like, he's on the ballot, actually, even though he endorsed Trump.
Yes, he would be. Yes. Oh, that's right. And he He did formally.
It was too late to pull himself off the ballot. Yeah, so he's still on the ballot, even though he's formally invoked, which is going to be very funny. People who vote for him. He's the true him. He is the, arguably a more, because of that, a more true protest vote than Jill Stein. But he's also a fucking Zionist shill, so can't countenance it. Yahya Sinwar is very, very funny, though. And it gets everybody mad, right? It gets all the right people mad.
Yes. I'm just thinking about the person who has to, like, record
the New York Times. Sorry. The most recent New York Times Siena poll showed the popular vote as literally neck and neck. Emerson and New York Times both on the same, like, day.
That's what I'm saying. It's a legitimate. It's not like a joke or a meme. I mean, it is, I guess, but not. It's also real. Like, we could very real. We could absolutely be looking at a situation where Trump wins the popular vote and loses the election. It's not a. It's a completely. It's a thing that could happen. Very, very much so. Yeah. And I guess that's my endorsement. To whatever, you know, the gods of chance. I fully endorse that outcome as the objectively funniest.
Also, that outcome keeps Trump in the game too. Like, he's running again in 2028 if that happens. Right? You have to. If you win popular vote, if you win the popular vote, unless you're like literally Hillary Clinton, who is like, you know, terminally unpopular, bro, that'd be so funny. Dude, you got me all charged up. I got a new outcome I want.
And that's also the kind of thing that could easily result from, I mean, you know, because you imagine, like, they keep, like, the electoral vote is decided maybe even on, you know, Wednesday, Thursday or something, but the counting keeps going, and Trump ends up in the lead.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. Probably votes don't matter, so.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's exactly my point. We could only be so lucky. We could only be so fortunate as to live in the timeline. Anyway, yeah, so it'll be to see what happens. And anyway, in the meantime, I think that's a good place to call it. But as we're finishing, Dragon Age Veilguard has hit a new all-time peak of just over 75,000.
Nice.
Seems to be controlling again for the day. So yeah, I think they need to hit. If only for narrative control, but I think also as an index for their general success. If they don't crack 100,000 concurrent on Steam, like, that's, I think, pretty objectively a financial failure. That means,
well, if it's at least 2 million, if it's a flop, if they sell under 2 million, because the way how much games cost these days, which is also an insane thing to think about.
Which is not to say that, I mean, again, the brand will be around, the studio will be around, EA will be around. They all have plenty of money. But in any case, we'll see what happens with that. But I'm gassed, and I think we've covered enough. So
yeah,
with that, take care and stay safe.
See ya.